Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Morelia Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python's Forum, www.moreliapythons.com. And I have two special guest hosts with me tonight. I have Zach Baez, and I also have Rob Stone. But real quick, before we bring them on, I'm going to talk. Howard called in, and we wanted to chat up Carpet Fest real quick. Howard Redding, Redding Reptile Breeders, what's going on?
Yes, sir. Not much. Another wonderful Tuesday here in the beautiful state of Maryland.
There you go.
Yeah.
We're, a week and some days away from Carpet Fest?
Man, you know, we started to touch on this back in January, and guess what? It's still not enough time.
No.
Still not enough time.
No shit.
Yeah, it's rough now that work's been busy for myself, and now it's crunch time trying to get everything together. But it'll be more than spectacular. It'll be better than the two previous years.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have some cool stuff that you know, it was kind of like, and I kind of felt that how it was going to fall together kind of last minute. You know, us Morelia people were procrastinators, no doubt. But, you know, we have some cool stuff. People stepped up. You know, to start off the auction, we with the Carpet Fest T-shirts, we raised $486.83. and that's going to go to, I guess that's going to go to Rico. And then we have the auction. And that should be live by tomorrow on the Facebook page. And, you know, people can check out there and start the bidding. But, you know, should be cool. So what's going on? What did you want to hit us with tonight?
All right. Well, first of all, others first, because that way I can put it out there before I bird brain and ramble on about our own Carpet Fest. The Northwest Carpet Fest, July 26th. It'll be held in an undisclosed location so far. You'll get a text message and a time to meet, and no cops, please. No. it'll be somewhere between Seattle and Everett. They haven't exactly nailed it down right now.
Okay.
They're thinking maybe Bothell or whichever. They're doing the whole potluck style food thing as we do. They're doing, as we're trendsetters, what can I say? They're going to do the same thing, not so many animals, no animals, and more gift certificates and products.
Cool.
for the auction. That way, you know, it keeps things down, especially like we've discussed before, you know, this
sure.
time of year. Everybody's hatching out stuff barely, or I'm still dropping eggs, you know. So that's how they're going to do things out there as well.
Cool.
If you have any questions, you can email the lovely Heather Ashembo at mysticexotics@gmail.com.
Okay.
Or
yeah,
even
go ahead.
Or even check out her Mystics Exotics page, give it a like, and you can get in contact with her there.
Awesome. That's cool. Yeah, I don't know, man. I hope I'd love to be able to go out to that, but we've discussed that before. The tickets
Dude.
Are like what, $600 a piece?
Yes. I checked them a month ago and they're holding at $556. I
wow.
checked them earlier this week and they're at $600. And even with having a place to stay and having, you know, a shuttle service and $602 weekend? Sheesh.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's carpet bath, not Tinley.
yeah, good point.
If I'm going to lose money, at least I have a hope of making money.
yeah. So okay, cool. So yeah, that's the Northwest. Maybe maybe I can scrounge up the funds by that time and head out. I'd love to go. I think it would be awesome.
Debt. It's the American way. Why the hell not?
Yeah. Cool.
But on
so,
to the Northeast Carpet Fest.
Yeah.
It's go time. I'm really, really excited about it. You know, leading up to it, I'm kind of like, yeah, I got this going on, and then you have everything else going on in your life, and then it's like, oh, crap, it's real. Now we got it. And
yeah.
I'm really excited about it. There's going to be a lot of new faces here. Unfortunately, due to, you know, obligations, family and otherwise, a lot of the people that have been here in the past will not be able to make it. But I'm excited to get, you know, some new faces in here. And that's, you know, the whole purpose of it is to turn people on to this. So
yeah.
the people that are unable to make it are know what they're missing, but the people, the new faces coming in will be able to gain knowledge and talk to us that know or think we know, anyway.
Yeah, I think we know. It's more like it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, they've been on the planet 80 million years longer than I have, so anything
That's
else, they're teaching me stuff. I'm only learning.
Yeah, no shit. That's cool. that sounds. Because with work, right? I do my schedule a week in advance. And when I go and started writing up the schedule, I was like, "Oh shit, that's next week." You know,
right.
It's real. You know, like, oh, whoa,
yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah, it's happening. Guess what? By the way, it's happening.
Yeah, so it's cool. I got the stickers today in the mail for the Carpet Fest beer, Morelia Python Radio beer. So there you go. We got your ale for you. So that would be cool. But a whole bunch of cool stuff, like I said, for the auction. And, you know, I think it'll be a good time. And I'm looking forward to seeing new faces and meeting new people and, you know, tickling our inner herp nerd with each other, as Owen would say. So
Owen would say that?
That's what he says. That's his saying.
Oh my. Well, all I gotta say to that is just for Owen, for the love of God, man, you're tickling your inner herp nerd. Okay. Well, you know, you gotta realize he's up in Alaska right now drinking salmon flavored vodka.
Yeah, I know. I saw that. That's crazy.
don't bring me back a bottle. Just try it. I just
want
to try it. I don't want to drink a bottle of it.
he's going to bring it to Carpet Fest so we can try it and
that'll end up
I can't imagine that tasting good, man, but I know?
That'll end up like that stuff Casper had at iCast.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, that was a mouthful of nope. But is there anything, the only thing I can say is if anybody is planning on coming out, if you could give us just, you know, some notice or touch base with Eric or Owen or I via Facebook or the Northeast Carpet Fest page or, you know, anything, just so we have an idea. I mean,
yeah.
There'll be more than enough of everything for anyone that cares to join us. But it's nice to have, you know, kind of a heads up. I'm getting stuff together this weekend
right.
as I've been the last couple weekends. But anyway, it's nice to know what allotments we can make.
Yeah.
So that way there's more than enough time and space for everyone involved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, if you're sitting on the fence, it's definitely something – you know, if you're into carpets or Morelia, it's definitely something that you want to check out if you're able to. I promise you, it will be worth the trip, and you'll have a good time. You know, and you know, we always talk about how it's, you know, you're able to talk to these breeders and other keepers, and you know, able to pick their brain and understand what they're doing, and you don't have to worry about the whole, you know, people trying to sell snakes in between, you know. So
right.
So yeah, it's definitely a good time, and you get to hang out with Howard. So.
Oh, thanks. Okay, so you just never mind. Anyway. Yeah, and from what I understand, you know, we got a lot of very nice donations for the auction, a lot of nice stuff lined up.
We got a ton of cool stuff. I don't get the list in front of me, but I know Jason and Mo and Buddy, yourself, myself, you know, Owen, which. Just in that group alone, I mean, if you're looking to pick up a carpet this season, you pretty much have the whole spectrum covered right there with that group. You know, and then there's also the non-snake stuff, like the tattooing, you know. Shad is donating a day of tattooing, which is awesome, if that's your thing.
Yeah, by the way, Owen and I already discussed this because we're both going to – I already told Chad, I talked to Chad, asked if he was coming. He's like, with the new ink shop and everything else, he just can't make it. He's too busy. But he did put up that full days, which is, if anybody's gotten ink before, that's $1,000.
Yeah.
That's, you know, 8 hours chair time, a full, that's, yes, above and beyond. And I told Chad that I was going to win it, and I was talking to Owen about it. He said, no, I'm going to win it. So we're going to both win it. We're going to split it, go up there, and hang out with Shad and get inked up.
Cool.
But I don't want to discourage anyone else for bidding on it. By any means.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's for Rico and USARC, and they both, both of those entities can always use a little bit of money.
Heck yeah.
So In closing, I'm definitely really excited about, you know, all of the events, and I want, you know, everybody else to be fired up about it.
Yeah.
Man. Great food, great people, and if you haven't already allotted what you're planning on bringing for food, contact Owen.
Yeah.
That's about all I have. I just wanted to put it out there and pipe up on the whole Carpet Fest thing.
All right, cool, man.
This is the third year. It'll be great. And I don't want to take away from Rob's time. Enjoy your evening, guys.
All right, man.
All right,
see you
sir,
in a week.
Take care.
All right.
Oh, man, don't remind me. But, yeah. I only have a week. All right, folks, right. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Let's get these guys live. Hey, Zach, Rob, welcome back to Morelia Python Radio.
How you doing?
Good.
Dude, that was a heck of a segment, right? You've got Howard dropping eggs like a good monotreme, Owen tickling salmon for their juice. It's good stuff, dude.
There you go. I think, this can't be true. Is this Owen calling in from Alaska? Hold on.
Oh, God.
Owen, is that you?
Maybe. It might be.
Oh,
I don't know.
You couldn't stay away, could you?
I couldn't. It hurt. So I figure I would just annoy you for at least 5 seconds before I went out and did something else up here. So.
Okay. You having a good time on the trip there?
Your Facebook said you got your boat broke.
What I do?
Your Facebook said your boat got broken. So what happened?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Prince down to the boat broke. So, great. This will be fun, a helicopter ride later. But it didn't get to that point, so we just bounced around for about an hour and a half. And, you know, I was working with the eagles and stuff today, so. It's good day. You're covered in fish guts and bird shit, so. My friends are like, you take weird vacations. And I'm like, I take awesome vacations, but.
That was
a hand in vodka. Yeah, well, yeah. Obviously, reception is not good.
Just kind of leaves us in there.
Exactly. So, anyway.
In air or what?
But I'll let you guys go and do your show, and I'll listen on the plane ride home. So, remember, you're all sad and devastated I'm not there.
Right.
Yes, that is the General Assembly. So.
Yeah. Golden.
All right, good show, guys, and I'll talk to you.
See ya.
Later.
I knew he couldn't last. He couldn't last.
Nope.
So yeah, guys, we're just keeping it loose tonight, and we're going to chat up I don't know who that other. We're going to chat up just some variety of topics. How are you guys doing? What's up? What's new?
You go first, Zach. Okay. Over here, nothing much, man. My one and only pairing this year, the female finally dropped her clutch about, what is it now, almost 3 weeks ago. And so she's doing good. She's MI'ing like a champ. I mean, she's doing an amazing job. So I'm pretty excited about her. And other than that, everybody else is just, you know, it's the usual. I love, like, I think MI is, like, so great because I really, like, don't even check on her. Like, I these days have been going by so quickly. Like, it's already 3 weeks. So I can't wait. So other than that, I mean, not much is going on over here. That's about it.
Cool. Cool. How about you, Rob? What's new with you since the last time we talked?
Not a ton, man. It feels tight doing mostly Colubrids because I see all this cool stuff getting posted. And then we've had a really long, drawn-out, you know, presumably, global warming-induced crazy winter. So all my stuff has been super late, and I see on Facebook everyone posting all these eggs, even from Colubrids, and I'm going, well, maybe in a couple months I'll get some. So, I don't know, super cool, but you know, low key on this end for sure. So,
okay, cool.
What about you, Eric? Didn't you just get some more eggs?
Well, I'm waiting on the last. Actually, I probably have two more clutches to go. The one female, she should be laying probably tonight, I think. That's my Carmel Head Albino girl. So And then I got the albino to my citrus tiger. She should be dropping in a couple weeks. You know, it's funny. Owen went away, and he kept telling me that his eggs were probably going to hatch when he was away. And sure enough, they did. So he got a clutch of his super caramel jags, and yeah, they hatched. And he was all in a panic, and you know everything was cool though, worked out. But I know that the same thing's going to happen to me because I got the poison ivy clutch is going to hatch any day, and it's due right before we leave for Carpet Fest, and then the albino zebra jags, that clutch is about, I'm going on to Florida at the end of June, and that's when that clutch is due.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. Now, it's cool, though, when you have people that live around you that, you know, you can rely on, because, you know, my dad and my brother, they're cool for, like, taking care of snakes and checking in and giving them water and stuff like that, but when it comes to, like, eggs and No. I don't trust it. You know, I don't trust it. They could probably do it, but I don't know. I don't trust it. So yeah, that's really all I have going on. Today I finally sent out the Darwin mail to Andrew Paris.
Nice.
And we made up a pretty cool award. I posted it up. I don't know if you guys saw it.
Yeah, I saw it. That was pretty sweet.
Yeah.
The way they did it, where they were able to put the picture inside the, you know, like the glass or whatever they use. But, yeah, he'll probably enjoy that. He'll get to put it in his room or on a table or whatever. Who knows? It's probably worth nothing, but still.
Paperweight, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know? But, but, yeah, that's cool. So, you know, he should get that tomorrow. And, yeah, that's really all I got going on. But, yeah, we got some topics to talk about. And I don't know. I guess I'll start with the first one. And this is kind of a, like you guys were saying before we came on the show, this is kind of a hot topic at the moment. And it's big snakes and the responsibility of breeding them and selling them. And, you know, I guess when I was getting into scrubs, I didn't realize that, I don't know why, I guess I'm naive, I don't know, you know, but anyway, I didn't realize that other states, they're either illegal or you have to have a permit. And, you know, it kind of made me take a step back and think about, you know, is this something that I want to breed in captivity. So, I mean, what I decided to do for myself is to focus on the Halmaharas and the Moluccans and stick with those two scrub species rather than deal with the Barnecks. And enough people do them and do them well. And I just think that my thought is that, I don't know, I would be afraid of where they would end up. And ultimately, would they end up hurting the hobby or not? You know, it's one thing when you're dealing with a large Burmese, but it's a whole other story when you're dealing with a large scrub. I mean, that's, you know, I'm just talking out loud, but, you know, what do you guys think? What are your thoughts? You know, I think retics are kind of the hot one at the moment, because there's some breeders out there that kind of to pump them out, and they got to go somewhere. And I remember, I think it was Jasser that put up a thread about it.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about, you know, what's the responsible way to do it? Because I guess retics, when they lay a clutch of eggs, you're not looking at like 12 to 15.
Looking at 60.
Yeah, 60 eggs. That's a lot of snakes, man, you know? And it seems like that the morph thing has kind of, I mean, don't get me wrong, retics are beautiful, and some of the morphs that they have are insane. But I don't know. I have to kind of think about that and what's the responsible thing to do. So What do you guys think?
Who's going first?
I don't know. Whoever.
How about you go, Zach? How about we do it so Zach, you can go, and then I'll say something, and then you can hop back in or whatever. So.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I responded on that thread that Yasser put up because, you know, I see it as a problem. And, you know, you're talking about a lot of babies, and you're talking about very large snakes potentially. And so, you know, when I try to think about if I were to breed such a thing, right, would I ever feel comfortable selling those animals?
Right.
Just personally, I would have a hard time placing those animals. I really would.
Right.
You know, so, what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, said person has to go through an application process before they get a snake for me or, you know, something like that? Yeah, maybe. You know, maybe that's an option. I don't know. But, you know, when you think about scrubs, you know, you said that scrubs, you would be worried about selling them. It seems people who are into scrubs, okay, are not the same people who generally are into, like, retic morphs. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And scrubs, you're buying a scrub, you know what you're getting, I feel. I feel like there's not a veil there. You know what you're getting. You're getting a pretty animal that can be pretty pissed off and can get pretty large, has a very large head, a very large teeth, and, you know, it has a reputation, and so people who want to get into it, I find, tend to know what they're getting into before they get it.
Right.
And then you're talking about the amount of scrubs that are out there. I mean, it's minuscule when you compare it to any other snake, really, that's in captivity, I mean, large ones. But those retics, I mean, I don't know. I would love for there to be some kind of application process. I mean, if I was doing it, that's the way I would do it. But you're talking about it's a lot of work, it's a lot of time, there's a lot of effort. And when you're trying to make money, those are all things that are going to, you know, hit your bottom dollar, you know. So when you limit the amount of customers you can have because they have to go through some application process or something like that, then you're going to, well, lose money. So, I mean, where I don't know. I don't know. I think it's a really tough situation. I know a lot of people are trying to breed towards smaller retics. I mean, come on. A retic is a retic. I mean, you can have a super dwarf retic all you want, but
right.
Like, dude, it's a retic, man. And you know, and they're very hit or miss. Those super dwarfs, some of them stay small. Sometimes they tell you it stays small, and it really doesn't. You know, like it's really kind of shady, that whole thing. So, I mean, I don't know. At the same time, if I was a retic keeper, I'd be really nervous about all this talking going on. And I understand how a lot of them are getting really defensive. That's totally understandable. I would be defensive if somebody said that my animals, I couldn't responsibly sell them. So I understand that. But I think from my personal view, I think it's a tough one, man. You know, where do you draw a line? You know, like retics at reptile shows, like I don't know. To me, it just seems like a little strange to me. And maybe that's because, like, you know, been going to White Plains was, like, my main show for the longest time I was going to shows. And so, you know, there weren't retics there. There weren't berms there, no anacondas, no crocodilians, you know, and everything like that. But, you know, you go to Hamburg, and, you know, it's a wild, wild west. So, you know, you see those kids buying those retics, and you see those kids buying those anacondas or getting those Nile monitors or getting those Nile crocodiles for, like, $100 or whatever, and you see these kids walking out the door with it. And a part of you says is that, you know, the consumer should be more responsible and they should know what they're doing. But at the same time, come on, there's no doubt the guy knows. You know what I mean? He knows that snakes aren't going to survive the past couple of years or that alligator's going to survive or that crocodile. You know, it's the whole thing that, you know, all these animal rights guys are exactly saying. I mean, at some of their points are actually kind of on point, unfortunately. And I wish if we could police ourselves a little bit better, then we wouldn't be having these problems. If we said that no, certain things can't be done this way, and if we police these things, but that just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. And it's not going to happen because it's going to cost money. No matter what way you look at it, it's going to cost somebody money. Whether it's going to cost the show promoters money because you know, those animals can't be sold at the shows, or what is going to cost application fees and that sort of thing, and those types of work and the background checks or whatever that it may happen. But I think that we really need to think about what we're going to do in the future. Because unless I personally think unless we put our own, I know everybody hates this word, regulations on ourselves, that somebody's going to come and do it for us. That's what I think.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's the country we live in now, right, where everything's freaking regulated. You know,
right.
Unfortunately, that's just what it is. And so we can either let them do it or we can do it ourselves and have our own interests at heart rather than their interests. See what I'm saying? So I don't know.
Yep.
It's a tough one. It definitely is a tough topic, and for some reason right now it's pretty much at the forefront right now. I think a lot of people are talking about it.
Right. Okay. I have some points, but
yeah.
Go ahead, Rob. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I'm with you, Zach. I think it was at the fore, right, because of that radio show. I didn't hear the radio show, but I heard when they had McCurley on in response. And, you know, it's interesting, and I certainly all the stuff that you said, Zach, is valid, right? I would say that, you know, I've gotten wild jampias from Cameron that, you know, certainly males that were the size of, you know, big California king snakes. You know what I mean? Like clear, full-grown adults that are 5 foot long and maybe an inch and a half thick or whatever, and feed them for 3 years in the same darn size. But that's not most of them, and it's certainly not most of the captive ones. I think that makes a huge difference if they were, you know, kind of reared in wild conditions, right? With those that food ability and stuff, bonsaiing them, right, as Eugene likes to say. So I think that's part of it. I also think it's really relevant that, you know, like scrubs and retakes, man, they're just really smart snakes. You know, and Eric, you touched on this earlier, like a berm doesn't aim for your face, you know, and it's heavier body, but it's not really an apex predator, kind of unlike scrub, nominate scrub, king horneye, and retakes. I mean, retakes genuinely, they have a difficult time eating them, but they genuinely kill people in Southeast Asia every year. Like, that's a real thing.
Like, right.
Dude went out to fix his generator, didn't come back for 3 hours, and they went to find him, and he was, you know, a retake's trying to eat him and was getting stuck on the shoulders.
Right.
Like, that's a real thing, and it's not, it doesn't mean people shouldn't have them, because, I mean, they're awesome, right? But it does mean that, like, they're certainly not for everyone. You know, I don't keep them anymore, you know, just because it's not, mostly it's not my bag. I think I could do it, but it would require an investment of resources and time and stuff that, A, I don't think I'm really in the mood for, and B, probably wouldn't be appropriate in a house with small children who have no choice but to live with you. You know what I mean?
And
like,
right.
Like, I think the limiting factor is what you said, Zach. They don't survive to maturity. They're going to die through neglect or being frozen or abandoned or whatever long before they get to that size. And really, that's the way it's perpetuated. I remember Tom Crutchfield was on Reptile Radio back, what was that, Eric, 4 years ago, something like that?
Yeah.
And,
yep.
You know, he said, oh, well, the great thing about the green iguana market was that every year it was self-renewing because everyone's would die because they were maintained in poor conditions. So every year they could bring in 10,000 more, and the market was there because they never, you know, the ones from the year before were dead.
Sounds like the proverbial goldfish, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like, as an animal, that's not a green iguana, right? Almost universally is not a good pet. But one that's, you know, a newborn to juvie that's maybe like, what, under 20 inches total length, yeah, that makes a fine pet. You can stuff it into a 20-gallon. It'll be dead soon enough. It'll be dead before it outgrows it. And, well, next year is when the cycle begins again. And that's exactly your point, Zach. You know, and I think listening to the thing with Kevin was, I just felt like what you said was true. It was too personal for him. You know what I mean? Like, he kind of was missing the point, which was not that they're not amazing animals, and not that some people can't keep them. It's that Jay shouldn't be producing, you know, thousands of them. he has a clear financial incentive to do so, but eventually it's going to bite us in the ass. And in fact, there was a statistic that was, you know, incorrect there. Here in Denver, back in like 99 or 2000, someone was killed by their pet retic.
Oh, really?
Like they said on the show, you know, I don't know of anyone killed by a retic. Well, it happened in Denver. Dude was like eating fried chicken and then played with his retic, and it definitely constricted him. In
wow.
the town I live.
Wow.
Like, so not only has it happened, you know, it happened here, and I lived here when it did happen. Like,
wow.
And there's a big snake bin within the city limits of Denver. Like, I mean, I don't think it's totally surprising that those two things go together. You know? So, I mean, like,
yep.
I don't know. I just, it's one of those things where it's, I see the attraction, and you're right, Eric, man. Some of those retics are just amazing, right? Like, those cow retics, I mean, those things are crazy. Calico
right.
retics, one of my favorite snakes forever. But, and I mean, all this titanium, like, honestly, the two side thoughts, right? One would be, I know everyone wants to make combos, but I actually think some stuff looks better by itself. Like those titanium
yeah.
retics, I love a lot when they combine them with tigers and whatever, platinums and other plutoniums, and I'm like, dude, it's overkill, just give me the tiger. Or just give me
right.
the titanium, you know? Like,
right.
I don't want all that, you know, I don't want it to be four different things. Actually, just by itself, I think it looks better because it's got more contrast and stuff. So that would kind of be one point. And the other is just that, yeah, man, there's just so much of a... I can't believe that they're getting the prices for these things that they are. You know, I see the guy up in Wisconsin, Vital Exotics, who seems to be doing great with the black dragons, water monitors generally, those calico retics, the pied retics, which are also amazing, all this stuff, right? But, like, man, who the heck is he selling these things to? Like, who is he selling a $4,000 captive-bred black dragon to? Like, I mean, is it an awesome, awesome animal? You're darn right, you know what I mean? Like, no doubt. But, like, dude, that animal gets to, you know, full-blown water monitor size and basically would need, like, a third of my basement at a minimum. Like, who's he selling that to? Who
right.
also just happened to have $4,000 for a luxury reptile pet. I
yeah.
just tossing it out there, you know what I mean? Not that it's not cool, not that it's not awesome, blah, 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 but, man, it's just like, I'm with you. I see these retic prices, and it's like, by the time my animal gets to maturity in 5 years, are they even going to be legal to ship across state lines? I sure hope so. I mean, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool libertarian, and I think you can... do what you want as long as it's purely self-effacing, but it doesn't seem
yeah.
like that's the one that we live in. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah, and that's kind of like, I don't know. I've had a lot of experiences with keeping a lot of different types of snakes, and so have you, Rob. But, you know, I remember when I was just getting back into it, and this was, wow, like 1999, 2000, something like that. And I wanted to get a Burmese python. And I remember going to... you know, the local pet shops around here and whatnot. And I remember this guy saying to me, and at the time, you know, I'm like a 20-something-year-old, and, you know, I can totally understand where this guy was coming from, but he was like, why do you want that? Why don't you get yourself a ball python? Why don't you get yourself a, you know, a king snake or a corn snake or some other type of smaller type of python? Why do you want a Burmese python? You're going to have to put it in a room and shovel its shit and... it's going to eat rabbits and all, you know, all this stuff. But I had in my mind, I don't know if it's because I'm young or I don't know what it was, but maybe not mature in keeping reptiles. Does that make sense? You know what I mean? Like, it's like not thinking about maybe being selfish, I guess, you know, thinking about my own interest rather than the animal's welfare. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, for sure.
So it's like, oh, I want this, and I don't really care if I can take care of it the way that I should. And I'm just afraid that, you know, going back to the scrubs, which really kind of like, this is kind of like made me think about things as far as, you know, working with scrub pythons. It's like, I don't know that I necessarily want to deal with that, you know, like when I bought my scrub python from David Means, you know, it was kind of a process that I had to go through in order to get it. And, you know, I reflect on that a number of times throughout, you know, the years of our show, because I have to really look up to that guy, because he wasn't just going to sell it to me based on, you know, here's some money and I want to sell the snake. You know what I mean?
Which is really a compulsion, right, for something that's not that popular. Like, it's even more impressive, right, because I'm sure he didn't have people banging down his door.
Right.
No, and they were a high price. You know, it wasn't like it was cheap. You know, you're talking about captive born and bred, and he put a lot of his passion into this, and, you know, but I don't know. For me, I just have to think about, I guess it's like I'm policing myself. I love scrub pythons. I think they're awesome. You know, I really do. But, like, to me, I say this a lot, but, like, carpet pythons are that perfect python size, I believe, you know, and maybe that's because I'm biased and I feel, you know what I'm saying, but you could put ball python in there, you could put chondro in there, but I just don't think that everybody should be owning the larger, you know, pythons. I don't think that they're for everybody. And I'm not that guy that likes to come along and tell people what they should or shouldn't have, but I hope that they would listen to my experience. And now that, you know, I am where I am with my collection and whatnot, I realize that, I don't know, again, maybe it's selfish because I don't feel like dealing with, you know, because it's not easy working with these large
right.
pythons that want to kill you. You know, you have to take these extra precautions that you may not necessarily need to take if you're keeping a chondro or, you know, a carpet. You know, if a carpet nails you, yeah, it hurts, but it's not the end of the world, you know. But if you get bit by one of these big, big snakes, you really shouldn't even be handling them if you're by yourself, you know.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't know.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, do you think that retics in general draw a certain audience, meaning that, you know, whether it's their price or their morphs or their size, their impressiveness, do you think it draws a certain type of, oh, I don't know, 20-something, you know,
yes,
guy full of machismo? You know what I mean? Like,
yes. You know what
probably,
I think?
Right?
I think that you have... You have that guy, I guess it could be a girl too, but you have that guy that thinks ball pythons aren't cool, right? But here you get this cool, quote-unquote, snake that has the same type of idea as a ball python. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, you can make this morph and that morph and da-da-da-da-da-da-da and, you know, put all these together and you get that
right,
whole ball python feel, but in a more, for lack
impressive
of a better
snake.
Term, yes.
I mean, heck, dude, right? They're certainly one of the top five most impressive non-venomous snakes in the world.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, bar none. And so, like, I say top five, I would say the first, but, you know, certainly there are other contenders. It's just that it's one of those things, right, where it's like, I think there are some people who just have the right approach and the right mindset and the right technique to deal with that and to appreciate that it is an apex predator, right? I mean, it's the same desire we see with people who keep tigers and shit, right? You know, like, it's you know, clear, and it's certainly a connection to nature, but at the same time, then when when viewed in the context of, like, oh, I can breed them like ball pythons and make these little colors and stuff, it's like, yeah, that shit kind of goes out the window when the snake you're pulling out is, you know, a 14-foot female off those eggs and is trying to bite your face off. And, hey, now I've got 45 little babies that I've got to move that, you know, will get 8 to 10 to 12 feet if they're a male. And who knows, 14, 16 feet if it's a female. Wow, there's plenty, you know. I don't know. I just have a hard time believing, in a certain sense, right, that there's maybe 45 people prepared to take on those snakes. And that would be if they all wanted to buy them from me, all had the money to do so, you know, blah, 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 blah. And yet when Kevin was on the show, was presented to him that Jay was producing literally thousands a year. literally 1,000. And interestingly, he defended Jay, but he didn't dispute the point, which suggests to me that the number is right. And it's just like, man, it's true. Where the heck are 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, whatever the number, the undefined number in the thousands is, where the heck are those things going, dude?
Yeah, exactly.
And
if we're just shipping them overseas, like, that's definitely not sustainable. Unless they're just raising them up and slicing them and cooking them. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yeah, but even so, who's going to spend, you know, $5,000 on them? That's a pretty expensive steak.
On a handbag, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. You know?
I don't know. You know, I think it's a breeder's responsibility, right, to put the, especially with new people coming in, to put them with the correct reptile to work with. You know, I think that a breeder should be able to, you know, take a look at somebody after talking to them and get a feel for what they could or couldn't handle. You know what I'm saying? Like, I use this as an example. You know, I remember me and Owen were vending in a reptile show, and we had a couple people come up to us, and they were talking about they wanted to get into chondros. Well, that was going to be their first snake. And I'm not saying that you can't have a chondro as your first snake. You absolutely can. People do, and they're successful with it and whatever. But I think that you kind of have to learn a little bit about keeping reptiles before you take on a reptile that is not as forgiving. Is that you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so, like,
sure.
To me, I would say that, you know, okay, so if you want to keep chondros, you should get yourself a carpet python. Get a feel for it. You know, very similar, but, you know, if you get something like, you know, I don't know, coastal, or it could be any carpet, they're a little more bulletproof, you know, a little more simpler. And then if you are able to kind of do that, then move on. You know, you get a feel for, you know, a feel for how to take care of it, what those requirements are. And I don't know, if it's always been that if I don't have something and I know somebody else has something, well, I'm going to point them in the direction to somebody that I know that has that, you know. And maybe if they're coming in, a carpet python isn't their thing, you know, maybe you send them to somebody, you know, like Bill that has carpet pythons, but also he does ball pythons, you know, or Marcel Mendez, or, you know, some guy like that that, you know, you can eventually build up to that snake. Start off with something there, because you don't want the person's first experience to be a negative one. You want it to be a positive one. So,
for sure.
I don't see.
I
that,
mean, what?
Though.
There are only 3,000 species of snakes or something like that in the world. So it's not like there's one for everyone. Oh wait, there's a perfect one for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it doesn't need. Maybe it's not even a python. You know, but. You know, some people, they have that idea in their head that it feels more, I don't know what the, you know, more impressive, I guess, if, oh, I have a python, you know, type of thing.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, we know all those guys. We see them walking down the aisles at the reptile shows. You know
yeah.
what I mean? We know the type, you know, where they're looking to buy the biggest and baddest thing they can for the least amount of money. And, you know, unfortunately, with the rate that the retics are being produced, you know, and with the morphs in mind, what happens to all the normals, right? What happens to all the ones, the less desirable of the morphs?
Yeah.
Again, we go back to that same thing. So, you know, the prices on those animals are going to drop down as the popularity of those retics get more and more. So then what do you do with 50 normals that nobody wants to buy? And that the price going for them is $50. I mean, what do you do with them? I mean, you know, at that point, we have to start talking about culling, in which nobody wants to talk about. You know what I mean? Like,
Rick,
so
you
got to
do something, because that's a lot of mouths
yeah.
that builds up real quick. You know, like, that's for sure.
I mean,
said
the fighting
snakes, right? Like,
you said the C you know. Word. Oh, no.
Oh, my.
Yeah. No, but, I mean, you know, at the prices retics are right now, you know, some of these morphs and stuff, you know, people who are buying a $10,000 retic are probably going to take good care of it. You know what I mean? So Currently, yeah, you know, maybe people who are getting into the retake morphing or, you know, totally responsible and everything else, but you can't just, you can't help but think about what's going to happen in the future when those prices do eventually drop like they always do, and then you have all these excess animals, what's going to happen to them? You know, where is this going? What's the end goal here?
Right, and it's not saying that they're not amazing. I mean, that was, I guess, the, you know, and I know Kevin, known him for years and years and years, and that was my only frustration coming out of that was, like, he seemed to be taking it as though there's no, you know, a statement like there's no redeeming qualities to retake. And as I said, I didn't actually listen to the first show or whatever what they said, but I certainly heard the discussion that night, and it right. wasn't that at all. It's not that they're not amazing animals. In fact, it's the opposite. It's a statement that they are. And that, like, you shouldn't have people who aren't equipped, you know, trying to interact with that amazing animal.
Right.
Right, right. And I think that's where I think a lot of the retic guys are getting kind of, like, on the defensive, and I get it. But I don't think any of us are saying that they shouldn't be able to own these animals. I don't think there's one reptile person out there, Herper, who's saying that you shouldn't be able to own venomous if you want to, or you shouldn't be able to own retics if you want to, or scrubs, but, you know, there should be a little bit of a process there, you know, to try to limit or reduce the amount of people who can have access to them, so only the most dedicated people can have access to them. I mean, that should be, you know, that should be the goal, you know, and I think just talking about that, people are, you know, automatically, they don't want nothing to do with that, you know.
Right.
I don't know. I think it would have to take, I mean, for things to change. See, I don't even know. I really don't. People are stubborn as hell, so I don't know what would... It's just true, man. You know, like what would it take? Would it take, like, U.S. ARC to come out and say, hey, guys, we believe that these regulations should come into play. We believe that there should be an application process for retakes. We should really... You know, if, let's say U.S. ARC came out and said that, right, which would be a totally valid thing to say, everybody and their mother would be up in arms, saying, oh, screw them, oh, you see what happened? Now the Andrew Wyatt's on a part, nobody cares about, you know, like, everybody will just, like, it would be a big clusterfuck, you know what I mean? Everybody will just go crazy, and nobody would think, you know, be responsible about it. Everybody will start pointing fingers, and, you know, oh, you're just trying to throw us under the bus, and, like, you know, oh, yeah, it would be a disaster. So, because there's too many damn egos involved. So we're, at that point, like, we can't, as a community, progress if everybody's just out for themselves. You know what I'm saying? If somebody's got to sacrifice a little bit. Everybody has to sacrifice some, I think, if we want to continue to do what we're doing today and continue to do it 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. You know, it's not easy. We have a tall order to try to pass here, to try to get through here. And unless we're willing to change some things and accept some things, you know, it's much easier for the government to just ban it outright. It's much easier.
Right.
It's a lot less paperwork.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, I mean, that's true. And I don't know. I guess it's just, I don't even really think that it's regulation. It's just calling for, like, just respect for other people and for the, in all honesty, the animals themselves, right? Like, I don't know. I just feel like, certainly, it's just not a good look, right, when he's hacking into those eggs and shit. You know, like, and I don't think that's unfair of me. You know, it's not a good look.
Oh,
and he's fishing around, and it's just like, come on,
the
bro.
The finger,
like,
in there, the dirty-ass fingers.
I mean, it works. You know, obviously it works, and he's not losing animals, and what, and he's been doing it for years and years. I'm not saying any of those things, because it's obvious that those, you know, those are obviously defeated points. It's just a basic case of being like, dude, you know, certainly, if, Eric, I doubt you'll start doing that with your eggs this year. You'll have 3-4 clutches. I really don't think you'd be jamming your finger in there. I think that's the product of having produced thousands. You know what I mean? So it's like, you have your eye, you know, the trained eye, and it's just like, anything cool? Nope. And it's not, I'm not even suggesting that there's not, like, you know, the basic joy, right? Like, even Eugene is like, well, I'm just as into every baby corn snake as the fanciest ball python that he hatches or whatever. So it's not, I'm not saying that, but I am saying something seems to be lost. You know what I mean? And it's just like, he loves snakes, but he needs to make sure that he's doing that in a way that's responsible. And I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, and you know, I think that my thoughts as far as scrub pythons go is me policing myself. You know, that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm not going to, like, I think of my animal Tweed, right? To me, that animal will always be in my collection, right? I think he's just freaking the greatest, coolest snake, you know, ever. But that doesn't mean I have to breed him. You know, I think that a lot of times,
right,
you know, we lose focus on telling people that it's not all about the breeding. You know, sometimes it's just about, you know, keeping them. Sometimes keeping snakes is just cool. You don't necessarily have to breed them to have cool experiences with reptiles.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was Owen was saying a few weeks ago, right? Like, well, why do people start breeding snakes? It's just because it's something to do with them. You know what I mean? Like, it's something, like some sort of stimuli to put in there and see what happens. And then, you know, more than anything, right, because, well, and this is a good-natured rip, but we don't want to be Vita, right, who's just posting a new picture of the same snake every, you know, 2 weeks or whatever, which, as
right,
I say, good-natured, because these snakes are really cool. But, you know what I mean? It's just something to do. Like, I think that's a big part of it. And when we take a step back and say, yeah, like, maybe this apex predator should just be cool by himself, you know, and that doesn't undermine his value at all.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm saying. Like, you know, I think it is a natural progression to end up to get to the level of breeding. You know, like when me and Owen were talking about it, you know, we were talking about that same topic, and, you know, that's what he said. You know, you get to a point where, you know, feeding your snake is cool, watching the snake shed is cool, you know, and now you're at another level where you're like, okay, well, what happens if I breed them? You know, what is that experience like? And I wonder how cool it is to see the eggs hatch out. But I think that one of the things that I myself police myself with is that I'm not going to breed snakes that I – what happens if I don't sell them? You know what I mean? Like, what happens if they don't sell? Am I prepared to house and keep all these snakes? And that's kind of how I look at it, you know, and I think that's the responsible way to look at it. I don't think that everybody looks at it that way all the time, but I'm not ready to, even with carpet pythons, I'm not going to breed, you know, 50 clutches of carpet pythons just because I can, you know, because I don't have a way of keeping them if I can't sell them. Yeah.
Right. And I know Nick says, you know, to that, right, like, oh, they always sell. And I think that's true, but it's true relative to the effort you put in and the time frame you're working on, right? But, like,
yeah,
would you have room to keep – so they wouldn't – you know, if you were to just hunt for a reasonable buyer who you thought would be completely responsible at the price point you wanted to sell them for, would you be able to keep a, you know, clutch of maybe 12 to 15 amethystina, you know, Barnex for – I don't know, 18 months, 2 years? Probably not. You know,
no.
Or at least if you did, they certainly wouldn't be getting fed every week or on the same rate that they would if you only had one.
Right.
You know, and that's just true because it's not feasible.
Right. And, you know, I think it's just, I don't know. You know, with Nick and the way, with Nick and saying that they always sell and all, I mean, well, with Nick, he does this full time. That's his first advantage.
And he puts out a ton of effort to do it, or at least he could. You know what I mean? When he really wants
sure
to do something, he will. You know?
Sure. And even Nick said, you know, he used to have one of the largest collections of scrub pythons in the U.S. But, you know, it's like it comes to a point where you have
that's
all this
not,
space,
yeah,
and what are you getting out of it? It's a little return, especially if you're doing it for, you know.
For your livelihood,
yeah.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
And, I mean, heck, dude, we've even seen, except for you, with your selling the heck out of that tandem bar today, you know, I mean, honestly, the market interest, they're not for everyone. And even then, the people that they are for, maybe they just don't have the money. You know what I mean? It's just not the easiest thing in the world to sell.
Yeah, I was listening back to the show when you were on with Owen, and you were talking about how, like, species that are hard to breed, or, you know, the whole topic came up of the rare reptiles and, you know, what makes it rare, and all of a sudden it becomes rare, so it becomes cool. And, you know, and you had made a good point that you said that the guy that probably could work with a snake and breed it successfully in captivity may not be the guy that has the money to buy in to that project, you know, and that kind of kind of stuck with me, you know what I mean? So, like, I think of you, Zach, right? I know probably I would bet a weekly paycheck of mine if you had Bolin's pythons, I think you could get them to breed.
I breed the shit out of those things.
and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because you're very detail-oriented, right? And I think you try to figure stuff out. And you are very, like, when you're into something, I see you, like, you know, because we message each other every day. And, you know, you're always like, well, this is what I do, and this is why I do it. So you're thinking. So to me, that tells me that if you had those snakes, you'd be doing that. But here's the problem. You probably don't have $7,000 in order to purchase those snakes. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Exactly.
No.
Yeah.
So then you get somebody that has the $7,000, but is not going to put the time in. And don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that people that have bowling pythons don't put the time in or whatever, you know. But I think that point stuck with me that, you know, that the guy that probably would be successful with them probably is the same guy that can't get them. So,
You know, it's funny you say that. I was talking to my vet the other day, and so she knows I'm a big Morelia head. And she was saying that she has a client who, you know, got a Bolin's python a couple months ago. And, you know, she's like, Zach, this guy came to keep his ball python healthy. I'm like, oh, it just started making, I was dying laughing. She's like, I don't know what he's going to do with this Bolin's. What happened?
That just proves my point, right?
Exactly. Yeah, of course. It's because that's exactly what she was saying. She was like, this guy, he's always in here with his ball python. I don't understand how he thinks he's going to take care of a Bolin's. And you know, she was like freaking out. She's like, I just think he's going to die on him. This is a very rare snake, Zach. I'm like, I know it. She's like, I don't understand. Where did you get $5,000? I don't understand. She was like, can you talk to him? Can you message him? Can you try to get him on track with this thing? You know, he's like, he clearly bought this as some kind of status symbol. I don't know what he's getting at. Oh, I was dying laughing. It was probably the funniest thing. And my vet is like, she's really cool, and oh man, it was super, super funny. I was like, I don't know, I hope he's doing it right. She's like, I don't know. I was like, well, luckily, a lot of people say they're easy as hell to take care of, you know. They're like, you know, Bolin's are pretty bulletproof. So, I mean, you know, in that respect, I say, well, maybe he'll do better with this than the ball python. I don't know. I'm like, I don't think so. I don't think so, Zach. I really don't think so. I said, okay, well, let me know. But yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, you know, that's true. I mean, I would love to have, you know what I mean, Bolin's. I mean, I would love to have monkey tails. You know, that's a big thing. But I can't. I mean, I just don't have the resources, don't have the space, don't have the time to take care of those animals. But yeah, I don't know. It's a shame because you're dead on. People who are passionate about things not always can get those animals. You know,
right.
But yeah, that was funny. That was funny you said that because, like, you know, I kind of dealt with that a couple months ago. It's so funny.
There you go. Awesome. Yeah, so yeah, that's kind of that topic. I don't know, you know, hopefully, like, I hope that people understand that. I'm not saying that you shouldn't own large constrictors. I don't think that, you know, I think that maybe if we took a page from the and I don't know, maybe you would know this, Rob, but the venomous keepers, are they more responsible when it comes to that? You know, I don't know. I think about Hamburg and, you know, just kind of like somebody walking out with a monocle cobra. You know, it's like, oh yeah, it's my first name.
Wild.
You know, and
yeah,
it's like,
I think we should take a page from the Australian guys, man. I think they got a system down there that's pretty. I mean, they're new, so it's kind of a, you know, it's not a big community down there, so they can do. You're starting out, right? So they can do things that us as a much larger community is going to be hard for us to implement. But, you know, they have, like, that tiered system where, you know, you have a license in order to keep reptiles. And, you know, the first tier, you can keep chimpanzees, pythons, blue tongues, that sort of thing. And then the second tier, you can keep carpet pythons, yada, yada. But in order to get from tier one to tier two, you have to spend more money. You have to pay for it. And you also, I think there's an application process involved. That sort of thing. So, like, let's say if that was...
Right, and you're proven hours that you've worked with the species and stuff.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like, let's say if that was here, right, you would have, like, ball pythons as tier one, maybe carpets and chondros as tier two, then you would have, like, you know, retics and berms and, you know, as tier whatever, four, or, you know, and venomous as tier five, you know, top tier, you know, so that way there's almost, like, you can build up, you know, there's almost like a training involved. You can't jump into the deep end of the pool. You got to kind of work your way there. I mean, I think that's a genius system. As Americans, I don't think we'd be able to handle that. But
right. Yeah, I don't think we believe in that, you know, as a general American or whatever. But I'm with you, and I think the hope just becomes that we influence people to make those sorts of decisions. You know what I mean? Since the system doesn't exist, that we lead people to those choices. And heck, dude, I mean, I know people keep tossing ball pythons, but it's like, dude, how about a king snake? You know what I mean?
Right,
eat every time, and it eats a mouse that costs you, you know, two quarters a week instead of, you know what I'm saying? Just like, let's be reasonable.
Yeah,
so
I think...
simple snakes, I mean...
I got to agree with you there, Rob. I think that sometimes, you know, I think back to my earlier years, I had more positive experiences with my colubrids that I kept than I did with my ball pythons. And, you know, I think about ball pythons, and when they go off feed, sometimes they're impossible to get going, you know, and I think that all has
actually
to do with their – go ahead.
Well, I was thinking – I know I tossed out the software thing because you guys are both working with them now, I believe, but – the funny thing about that, so I was, when I bred them, man, 2008, I had them just, you know, I thought it was cool. I like weird, you know, rodents and stuff, and so I got some really just for the heck of it, not for, you know, any particular, there wasn't a particular goal species I was trying to feed with them or anything like that. And, you know, I had worked with them and had some success, and as I say, maybe hit on that later, but the general point would be that I worked at a liquor store with this guy who was, oh, maybe in his late 30s, early 40s, who had a young son, maybe 8, 10 years old, something like that, who had a pet ball python, and the thing hadn't eaten for 9 months. And I said, hey, that's an interesting problem. I tell you what, here, I'll give you one of these softwares. The thing ate it the second it hit the floor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, it was just, it was great. It was unbelievable. And I was like, well, here, you can, you know, have all the rest of these. It just coincided well. And I said, here, you know, go for it. But, you know, it's like, okay, that snake just very particularly didn't want a rat, didn't want a mouse. It was waiting for that software, and the second it hit the floor, it was gone.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, maybe you got a point there, you know. I know that some of my pickier carpets, when I offered them soft furs, they took them with a gusto. I was like, there was no, you know, IJs can be fussy at times.
Totally right.
Yeah.
You find them the most fussiest, right? They're the fussiest of the, damn IJs.
Well, they need some negative because they're the coolest in all the other respects, right?
Of course.
Exactly.
You gotta have a checks and balances, I guess. But I mean, you know, sometimes, oh man, you know. So I have some IJs that, you know, slam everything, and then, you know, I have like two that are, you know, it's a pain in the butt. I have one that won't even take the African softer. But you know, my jungle male was a mouser forever. his first breeding season, he didn't eat for 5 months because, you know, I didn't see him all throughout breeding season, you know, cool down, warm up, anything. And he took a rat right after. And then, like, you know, a week later, he didn't want rats anymore. And then now he's eating African softers. You know, he wasn't hungry. If he's really hungry, oh, he'll take what he can get. But, you know, then he's still getting picky. But African softers, I see work 9 times out of 10 for sure. They're amazing. I wish I could feed everything African softers.
Yeah, they're kind of the perfect Morelia food when you think about it, because they're kind of like you can get the size of a mouse, but it's, you know, or
you're
trying
to get a jumbo mouse, but not fat. Yeah. It's like
almost. Yeah, I hate those jumbo mice. Oh, I hate those jumbo mice. You feel them, they feel fat. And
it's gross, dude. It's gross.
Yeah, you feel their spine, and you can feel all the bones in their spine. So they're clearly like an old animal that has like no muscle tone on it anymore. It's just fat. Like, those are disgusting. Yeah. I don't like seeing those things. And so I think, like, you know, the African sulfur is like that perfect thing, especially for my conjurers. I forget it. I think African sulfur is the way to go for those guys for sure.
Yeah, and I wonder if, speaking of conjurers, I wonder if you would see any kind of issues subside with prolapsing and stuff, because you'd be able to get that size of a rat without the the coarse fur, you know what I mean?
You know, it's interesting you say that because, you know, with my Biak, she's a thin girl because I keep my conjurers thin, but, you know, she has some size to her, and you know, I was feeding her mice, like large mice, because I didn't want to go to that jumbo. So I was feeding her large mice, and, you know, she would eat like 4 of them, you know, like every three weeks I'd feed her a mouse, and she would just not poop for 3 whole mice. You know, I mean, a couple months she just wouldn't poop because it's a lot of little meals, and so it just kind of like, it just built up. Thank God nothing ever happened, and, you know, she was never dehydrated or anything like that, so she always passed them eventually. But now that I've switched over to African softers, which is a larger meal, it seems that she's more consistent. So, like, a meal goes in, meal goes out. It's not like meal, 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 then it goes. You know, it feels a lot more consistent, and I think she's better off, at the end of the day.
So it's more like a chondro, less like a blood python.
Because she was like pulling off a blood python. I remember I contacted you and Dave, like, dude, she refuses to poop. Like, you know, does she look that stuff? Not really. But she hasn't pooped in like 3 months, and we're like, oh man, what the hell's going on? Soaked her, nothing, done nothing. She pooped, and it was you know, wasn't a dry poop, so she was clearly hydrated. She just didn't have to because the meal wasn't large enough. So I feel like now, you know, that I moved to the African softers, I've seen a big difference.
Huh.
So I think that's the way I'm going to go. Yeah, a little bit. And you know, talking to Danny Natish, you know, he's saying, you know, that chondros in the wild, they eat pretty decent-sized meals. Babies eat pretty decent-sized meals. You know, there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to digest and consume something of a large size. So for me, it's
I mean, that's how snakes work, right, in the wild.
Right.
And that's why they grow the way they do is because, like, you know, if you feed the same mass of prey, but over, you know, a larger item versus multiple smaller items, they grow. I mean, it's been studied, they grow better, or they, better meaning more significant growth, on the single larger item. And as long as that's, I mean, that's how they do it in the wild. I don't think, certainly I'm not advocating, you know, feeding these, you know, improper food items, right? These fat, those jumbo mice and whatever, or even rats, because honestly, dude, I don't like the feel of rats myself. I can't imagine trying to digest one. You know what I mean? Like, and it's like, maybe, you know, the little bag, you know, like the little hopper, you know, hoppers up to weaned or whatever, don't feel that way. They're nice and soft and stuff, but like, man, above that, like, I'm like, I wouldn't want to eat that thing, you know, and certainly stuff does and whatever, but it's just like, I'm not surprised stuff gets blocked up eating that.
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking of chondros, since we kind of segued into that, you know, what's your experience with chondros to date? Like, and you know, Zach, I know you're kind of new to keeping chondros, and I know Rob, you kind of have a nice group of chondros. What, you know, I should answer Buddy's question first. Buddy's question was, you know, on that title, he was asking why he wants you to come pick up Chiquita's brother, Zach.
That's happening. Yeah, that's going down. Harvest is next week, man. I gotta get a quarantine. I gotta get a tug ready over here. That's going down. That's happening for sure.
And he wants to know why I don't have any chondros, and only Owen only has two chondros. you know, well, I think Owen's limit is three, and I don't think that Owen's gonna budge on that. I think everybody has this idea that Owen's just gonna sell his carpets and move on, but that ain't gonna happen. I know Owen. He's like, yeah, it's cool, but you know, you got to earn your keep here at Rogue Reptiles.
Yep.
He's not gonna.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think if we know Omac, right, he's either going to have six next year or zero, is my feeling.
Oh, man, that's true.
And guess where they're going to go?
And they're going to go over to Eric's place. It'll be cool.
And then Eric's going to regain his chondros back in the chondro world. So. But yeah, man, I don't know. I'm talking to these chondro guys, and, you know, they're cool. I have the itch again. But, you know, it's just a matter of getting shit situated before I take the jump again. So, but anyway, so what's your experience with chondros, and, you know, how's it going for you?
I guess I'll start again. Chondros are the easiest snake I keep. They're no work at all. Because I don't feed them as much as everybody else, so they don't poop as much as everybody else. And even when they do poop, I don't even have to take them out of the cage to clean it. Like it's amazing. They're asleep the whole time while I'm cleaning them out. You know, they're not striking at my face, they're not striking at my knuckles. You know, they're not trying to crawl across the floor. You know, it's just super easy. But you know, there was a bit of a learning curve at first. I'm not going to say it was perfect. When I started keeping them, luckily no major issues. But you know, I started with the Biak, which was a great animal to start with. So that would be my recommendation to anybody: start with the Biak if you're nervous about getting a new chondro, because you know, compare them to my Eru, go compare her to my Eru's, totally different animal in terms of shyness, in terms of confidence, that sort of thing. Any major change that my Eru goes through, you know, you can tell. Like, you know, it'll shut down. I mean, you know, you're not. It's gonna just sit on the perch. It's gonna hide. It's just gonna, you know, any major change, they seem to take it a lot more. They seem to be a little more shyer. The Biak, forget it. She's rock solid animal. I've even taken her to, you know, over here at University of Pennsylvania. They had for the veterinary students, they had a reptile handling course. And so, you know, they brought in all these different type of reptiles for people to, you know, to handle. And my vet, she said, you know, why don't you bring, you know, some of your carpets and some of your, one of your chondros or something. And so people can see what, you know, what an actual snake does rather than like what a ball python does. So they can like understand and not all snakes would just sit there for you. And so I was like, okay, cool. No problem. And you know, she was fine. You know, she was totally cool with it. She ate that night. You know, she was handled. She was in front of a lot of people. I got some really cool photographs. She opened her mouth to show the people the teeth, which impressed everybody. You know, and that sort of thing. And I mean, she was perfectly fine. Took her home. You know, she ate that night. So you know, Biaks tend to be a little. Tend to be a little more confident. So. That would be my suggestion. And she was great. I had her for a while. She was great. Didn't have problems. But what ended up happening is, as I started getting, you know, I got her during what? I got her in the spring. And I had her all through the summer. And what ended up happening is, as the temperature outside dropped, the heater in my room kicked up. And so the air in my room got super dry. So on the one hand, I believe Terry Phillip, 100%, and I believe that hydration is more important than humidity all day long. And it was working fine for a long time. I was never misting. I never missed it. Never had a shed problem. You know, pooped regular. Everything was good. And it wasn't until the heat in my room had to kick on in order to compensate and the room dried out is when I started seeing shed issues. But, you know, you're talking about humidity levels like 10%, you know, humidity. I mean, you're talking about bone dry in that room to the point where everything you touch was like static, you know, static, like super dry, like no moisture. And that's when I started seeing issues. She had a bad shed, and then she had an impartial shed. And so it was like, oh, man, what's going on here? But see, I kept sticking with that. No, it's all about hydration. The humidity doesn't mean a thing. And I was, like, stuck on that. I was like, why isn't this animal listening to me, right? Like, what the hell? There's, you know,
I know best. Come on.
Yeah, exactly, right? I'm yelling at this thing, like, wait a minute. What do you mean? You drink, you know? I change your water bowl every freaking day. Like, I don't understand why you're having shed problems, you know? You poop fine, everything. You're not dehydrated. What the hell is going on? And what I found is that lubrication that they use to shed, okay, if your humidity in your room is like freaking nothing, that lubrication is going to dry within no time. So she would start shedding, like you'll see like the front like quarter or so shed, and then the rest looked like it just glued on. And so what looked to me is that the lubrication that she uses to shed just dried up because, well, there's no humidity in the air and things just dry up. And I think that's what was happening. So I fixed it. I just started misting. I don't miss the snake. I just miss the floor of the cage, and I missed in the morning. And I do that maybe twice a week. I'll just spray it down in the morning, kind of tip the water bowl a little bit, and it's fine. I haven't had a problem since. But it dries up. By the end of the night, it's totally dry. Or by the end of the day, a couple hours, it's dry. I also did two things. I have a large water bowl on the bottom of the cage, so they usually poop in it, so it's more like a toilet, really. But and then I have, you ever see those perch bowls that you put in like a bird cage, you know, those stainless steel? Yeah. I have those situated right over one of their perches, like, you know, perch height, in the highest perch. So that way they just have to poke their head over and drink. And I've witnessed them drink from that a few times. So that way they have two choices. And one becomes a drinking spot and one becomes a pooping spot, and it just works out that way pretty well. That's it, man. Everything's been fine. You know, shedding has been great. You know, they've been eating great. But that's the one thing I had to change. And I was being stubborn for a long time. I was like, no, this is not the way it's supposed to be. God, it's only 80 degrees in this room. Well, why is she having shed issues? She's not overheated. She's not dehydrated. Like, you know, I was, like, so mad. I was frustrated. Everything I thought I knew was apparently wrong, you know. So I think that you want average humidity. All right. So if you're going to do the Terry Phillip method, or the VPI method, and you're like I do with my chondros, and they just get a flat temp of 80 to 82 during the day. If you're going to do that, then, and you don't want to spray as much, I think what you're trying to do is at least have the humidity at, like, average. When you start getting real low, like, yeah, I think then you're going to start seeing problems. So that would be my suggestion. Other than that, just really, everybody's room is different. And so that's something I had to experience myself. I had to figure out what works best. And luckily, I had an animal that was willing to put up with my, you know, stubbornness. It was willing to
what
put up with. Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, then that's another thing, right? A lot of people start with these, you know, potentially wild-caught stuff, farm-bred stuff, and or really small neonates or whatever. And, you know, those animals are not going to be as forgiving as something that is captive, bred and born in the United States. So, you know, I lucked out in that respect, I think. I think I made a good choice in doing that. And so now, yeah, everything's on, you know, on point. I just got a new chondro in a couple of weeks ago from Rico, a new Aru male who I freaking love.
Is that the one that just shed out?
Yeah, he just shed out. I had no idea. You know, I didn't even spray him. I haven't been missing him, but he's in a small tub, so I think that has something to do with it. Anyway, but yeah, yeah, he's doing a great job, and he fit right in, and I haven't had a problem with him. So, but that first one, I did have problems with. And I think, I mean, there is a learning curve. There really is. They don't like neglect. They don't like, you know, you can't be, you know, you got to be on top of it, or you're going to see issues. Luckily, mine were only minor issues, but you're going to see them. And that's my suggestion. Try to get an older animal to start with, you know, a year old, that sort of thing. And you know, something that's already eating consistently, something that's past that little delicate stage, I think you're going to be pretty on the money. And that's been my experience with Mondros.
I think that's, you know, I think that's super valid, Zach. You know, I know Eric knows full well that I'm always kind of a, you know, try to, right, if there's a consensus, I frequently push the other side of the envelope just to, you know, make it interesting, basically, if nothing else, right? With the farm stuff and whatever, and I'm sure that's mostly the fact that I've been, you know, trying to buy from Cameron for 15 years and then actually buying from him for the last 10 or whatever, you know, that I certainly am prejudiced in that way, but I think you hit the nail on the head right there with the real thing about the captive bred to me is two things. Is one, like, hey, it's supporting folks like you and me, you know what I mean?
Right.
We're breeding, and that's great. You know, is I think that's the first thing, combined with the fact that, like, you know, obviously it's very easy to support Buddy, who just, you know, wants so people to have such a good experience that he just gives the snake away. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
it's very
right.
easy to support him, you know, because it's like, okay, well, dude just is like, it's not a question of, oh, it might be on my site for $800, Owen, but you know what? For you, it's free. You know, that speaks volumes, right? Perhaps on multiple fronts, but certainly on his character, you know, and the way he approaches trying to get people into the species and stuff. And I think those snakes are a great option because they are bigger. And I think that's really the key, the ability to get, like, a bigger animal that's not a wild animal. I think that's
right.
Why when people say, oh, Captain Red and people do better, that's what it really is. It's that it's, A, not wild, and, B, not a hatchling. You know,
right.
Like,
yep.
I think, to me, that's the reason. It's not really that they're, you know, captive versus, like, genuinely bred in Indonesia. It's like you're getting something that's 100 grams instead of, like, 15. And if you have a dry shed or you miss a shed on a neonate chondro, and you're not, like, you haven't been keeping snakes for, you know, a decade and a half or more, that thing's probably going to die. You know, like,
yep.
That's just the truth. You know, if you had missed that shed and it had a bad shed and it was a Neo, that thing's probably dead. You know what I mean? Like, and that's not speaking to you. That's just true. You know what I mean?
Yep,
and so I think
yep.
that's the struggle that people usually have. In terms of the shedding stuff, I'm with you. I actually don't miss, but the issue here is, dude, what you're talking about, we have, in terms of our relative humidity, basically all the time. It's,
wow.
like, basically that dry all the time. And so I guess the things that I've seen is keeping them in tubs helps. And I will dump water on the bottom of the cage, like, just on the newspaper. And I know that's another common tactic. And you know what? They do great. Excuse me. But at the same time, I don't think they do as well as for folks who have a relative humidity that's closer to what they experience in the wild. And I think you're totally right about the lubrication drying out. And I think that's a product, right, of what they are physiologically designed for. Like, the amount of lubricant they produce is doubtless associated with where they're from. Like,
right.
I can tell you, I've had bad sheds on all my Indonesian reptiles, or at least, you know, an example of that species over the 2 decades I've kept reptiles in Colorado. Right, but, like, I've rarely, if ever, had a problem with buying Mexican king snakes. You know what I mean? That are from an area
right.
like this. Because they are naturally designed to produce more lubrication because of where they're from. And I think, you know what I mean? So that's, to me,
yep.
that makes perfect sense.
Right.
And it never surprises me. You know what I mean? Like, I could have a variable king snake sitting there with a completely dry water bowl, and it would shed fine. But a chondro in that same circumstance, it's probably, you know, days from death in a certain way, being made into a piece of jerky.
Right.
Yeah, Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
It's crazy, but it's just true.
Yeah, that's they're not as forgiving.
But, I mean, heck, maybe if you're in Louisiana, you know what I mean? It wouldn't – maybe it's not as different. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And maybe even in that circumstance, stuff that's designed or, you know, developed over time to be like the Mexican kingsnake will struggle a bit more if it's in Louisiana because it's, like, overloaded with that humidity.
Right.
Yeah. So how do you take it away?
I don't know. I've rarely, if ever, had
put
that
in
problem.
A 20 count.
I know, right?
Oh, well, that's cool. so you're not breeding chondros yet, are you, Rob? You're not at that.
No, no. I don't have any adult stuff. I've had adult stuff in the past. I had gotten in on those, you know, spectacular subadult kofiaos back in the day, and yaks and all sorts of just amazing snakes. But, you know, like anything, you get into stuff, you get out of stuff, and we all know about that. So,
sure.
Yeah, no, at this point, just raising some stuff up that I've got all from Ryan. Give him the plug. You should have him on. I know he's not super, you know, into the telegenic stuff or whatever, but, you know, he knows a ton.
Right.
He's the guy who clockwork, he works, he still works for Cameron a couple days a week or whatever, credit or whatever his arrangement is. But, you know, I think that's, if you are going to get stuff, he's a great guy to get it from because, as discussed with Gary, he's personally, if you're getting chondros or you see, you know, Underground or whoever selling Cameron's chondros, every one of those has been passed over by Ryan, you know, and that's really,
right.
It's worth it to pay the premium to him. If you're interested in the stuff, you know, that is coming through there.
Right. Now, you had, when we were talking about topics to do, to talk about tonight, one of the things that you had since we were talking about chondros, is you put chondro development, and is it determined by at birth, or is it influenced by external factors? And I don't know if you were talking about, like, I know we touched on this before a little bit with supplementation and such. But
right,
I know
yeah,
there was a thread
yeah.
over on MVF that I saw that somebody was talking about it as well. And I think it's one of those things that it's kind of like with the UV lights. And no,
exactly.
I don't have it set up yet to where I have my carpets on UV lights yet. Not yet. But I wonder if it's something that we do, I guess – my thought is that if you're able to breed them and keep them in captivity and they do fine, you know, is that good enough? You know, can we optimize their health and their breeding by like pushing the envelope a little bit when it comes to supplementation and, you know, UV lights and et cetera. So what were you thinking about that topic?
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. Those would be, you know, both those kind of lines of thought were what I was thinking. And honestly, I don't think anyone really knows the answer, but I'm super curious to hear what the chondro folks think about it. You know what I mean? Because it's like, it's always a question. And I know, you know, Vladimir had suggested, who had been the snake breeder on the farm in Indonesia that Cameron gets his babies from, had suggested, well, he thought there was something to it because you look at wilder roos and Merokis and they tend to look phenotypically more spectacular than the captive stuff. And the opposite is true for like Biaks. You know, captive Biaks tend to look more colorful. I actually kind of like the wild Biak look with those real dark highlights and stuff. But that being said, you know, certainly Zach's Biak, it would be rare in the wild, you know, less rare in captivity, more rare in the wild.
Right.
And it's kind of a question of, like, well, what is that about? And I believe that Ryan Young, right, thinks that it's at least somewhat a question of kind of generational inheritance, right? Like, so that it's, you're not seeing it in the F1s, but you'll see it in the F2s. But, I mean, I don't know. I think that's possible, certainly. And maybe even a partial answer. I don't think it's the full answer, because presumably, like, the parents of the, you know, the wild ones that are pretty were also pretty. I don't know why they wouldn't, you know what I mean? It just seems like, I think that's probably part of the answer, but not the whole answer. And I don't know. I just feel like, certainly, feeding carotenoids to animals makes them exemplify a lot of their oranges and reds and yellows more, because they just have an abundance of those materials to process in their body. UV, right, anything that's out in the sun tends to look better than when it's not, you know, when it's in your house under artificial light. And I think certainly some of that's just our eyes, but also some of that, I think, is coming through in the way that the animal's synthesizing the, you know, enzymes in their body.
Right. I'm going to think outside the box here for a minute. You know, as of, you know, I think January, okay, and this is kind of going a little off topic for a second, but I swear I'll bring it round again. As of January, right? So, like, you know, I get married, and, well, I got married, you know, for a couple years, whatever, and, you know, you settle in, you get comfortable, you know, I put on weight, right? So, I go on this cruise in January, and that's when you were filling in for the show. But anyway, at the end of the week, the elevator was out. I had to walk up to the top of the steps. And there was like, I don't know, 7 flights or something like that. So I have asthma, right? I have asthma. So that, you know, I walk up these flight of steps, and I get to the top, and I'm feeling like, I feel like shit. I'm out of breath. I'm like, Jesus Christ, you know, I mean, I know I'm getting old, but what the hell? You know, I can sit here and blame it. I can blame it on my asthma all I want. But the truth is that I'm eating shit, right? And my body's feeling like shit, right? And that's what it comes down
right.
to. So, you know, I come back from this cruise, have a total change in the way I think about everything about food. So for the past, since January, I've eaten nothing but natural stuff, you know? So, like, if it has 3 to 5 ingredients on it, that's it. I'm not eating any kind of, like, crappy stuff, no fried food, no processed, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So I dropped, like, 15 pounds. And the thing of it is that I feel better than I ever felt in my life, right? I feel like when I felt like I was in my, you know, late 20s, early 30s, like, you know, I'm not tired anymore. I have lots of energy. I'm ready to go, 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 go. So here's how I'm going to spin this around. So if you have somebody that's breeding rodents, right, and they're feeding them shit, aren't your snakes going to get that?
Right.
And they're going to be like shit? You know what I'm saying? So, like, if they're not, like, I would think that a diet of a rodent in the wild is they're eating all kinds of stuff. You know, they're not eating
berries,
rodent chow.
Eating, you know, yeah, certainly. Not, well, you say rodent chow, dude, I mean, most of these places, right, they're feeding sheep dog food.
Right.
$10 a 50-pound bag. You know,
right.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Like, which,
but,
is even,
wait,
which is even worse than the chow. You know what I mean?
So my question,
yeah.
My question is this. So is it possible, right? So I'm experienced this firsthand, right? It's what you put in is what you get out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say I'm at optimal health, but I'm definitely healthier than I was 4 months ago.
Right.
You know what I mean? I feel
yeah.
better. I'm not. And the crazy thing is that I get sick every time that people get sick at my work, right? Goes around like crazy. And I get knocked out. And it usually hits me in the lungs because of asthma, right? Everybody
mm-hmm.
gets sick. They all have pneumonia. And I don't get sick, which totally shocks me. Is this because of what I'm eating? You know, I'm like juicing and I cut out red meat. Like, it's the real deal, you know? But what happened is, like, where I was addicted to sugar and shit, you get, your body starts to get addicted to feeling good, you know, and I could, literally, I tell you, like, when I would drink this stuff, you would feel it going into your system, and you would be like, oh, man, you could just feel yourself getting energized, right? So my thing of it is that, is it possible that the reason that you're seeing our snakes drop dead, get our eyes, easily, et cetera, et cetera, is because they're not at optimal health, because they're not getting the optimal nutrients that they need. Is that possible?
Oh, yeah. I think that's almost certainly true.
Right.
I mean, we talked about it in the context of those jumbo mice, right? Like, dude, what about the boas? People feed out those jumbos, and then the boas, you know, drop dead and stink. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. Or Justin talked about, you know, feeding kind of a, you know, fat jumbo rat or mouse to one of his chondros, being like, eh, probably shouldn't do this. And, you know, 3 days later, it drops off the perch dead.
Right. I don't know. What were you thinking, Zach?
What were you going to say, Zach? Yeah.
I was going to say, you know, I mean, that sounds great, you know, that maybe that's key, and maybe there is some way to do that. But you would have to quantify that in a scientific manner. And so how do you do that? You know what I'm saying? For every species that we keep in this hobby, you know, because every species is going to be slightly different. How do you – my point is, who's going to be doing this stuff? I know that I can do my best to give my animals the best, but how can I quantify whether or not what I'm doing is better for them in the long run? I guess, you know, I guess you could see over the span of 20 years if feeding this over feeding that is better, you know, that sort of thing. Like, I know for me, feeding African softbirds is better than feeding, you know, multiple mice. I can see that, you know, automatically. But how do you go down to the exact nuanced science? I mean, you're talking about stuff that the agricultural industry has been doing forever. But you're talking about they're doing this on a much, much larger scale. And they're
this guy's got to bring us back to reality here, dude. What's he doing?
Yeah, I know, right?
What I'm saying is that all sounds great, and I'm with you there. I'm with you there. You know, but I'm starting to think, like, okay, so if you get an organically grown rodent, okay, let's just throw it out there, that eats berries, and you feed it insects, and eats everything that it does in the wild, and you keep it in a giant cage because it gets all the exercise the rodent needs to be nice and fit and lean and ready for your snakes, that rodent is going to cost $10.
No. You're missing what I was saying. See, you're going through the rodent. What I'm saying is that obviously you're not going to be able to do that to replicate the wild. So is there certain supplements, right, that is missing in the diet that can be or is there certain nutrients that is missing in the diet that can be given to the snake via supplement? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know how you would figure out what that is, but, like, just like he's saying, like, you're talking about these snakes, and if they have this in their system, they're going to look something. It's just like us. If you have certain things in your body, you know, your skin is going to look nicer. Your face is going to look brighter. You're going to look more – you're going to look healthier. You know what I mean?
I just mean don't feed gross stuff. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like, we just need to stop feeding, like, the lab surplus and stuff. And, you know, I have a vested interest. But, I mean, dude, we feed some stuff that's just gnarly. You know what I mean? And I think that's what Justin was talking about. You know, he just looked at it and was like, that doesn't look good. But, you know, whatever. It's thawed out. And, you know, it's either the trash or into the snake. I guess we'll try into the snake. You know what I mean? Like, That's what I'm saying, because obviously what you're saying is right. I'm just saying the basal level of, like, not have it be disgusting. And then if you combine that with what Eric's talking about with supplements and stuff, I mean, heck, dude, are you still doing that lorikeet stuff, or how'd that go with the homes?
Yeah, I mean, I do it. You know, when I got the one from you, right, I noticed a difference in the way that they look, right? Because the original one that I had was darker. Then it seemed like, I don't know, it just started going through this phase, and now it has, like, that olive green look to it, my original one that I had. I don't know, you know, and I don't do it all the time. I just do it every once in a while. And I don't know. I've had that thing since 2009. So
I think it's
5 years,
you know.
Pretty rock solid, you know. He's a male. You know, and one of the things about the Homs, I don't know if your experience with this is that I noticed that they're a lot calmer than other scrubs that I've worked with.
Yeah. They're not bad at all.
No.
I mean, you know, I tell you what, if they do latch on to you, that's funny, but especially on the back of the neck. But, yeah, no, I mean, totally. They're definitely not bad at all. Not bad at all.
So for the people that
unlike
don't
know. Like the Nauta or whatever, you know, which are just like little pistols.
Yeah, right. For those people that don't know, one of the things that I tried doing was, you know, that they were saying that, I think I was talking to Nick about this, and in why people were having problem breeding Halmahera scrub pythons, and he thought maybe supplementation was a problem because they're eating fruit bats over, well, that's the only thing that they've found that they've eaten. I'm sure they eat other things, but with the diet of rats, are they getting those nutrients, you know, that from the rat that they would necessarily get from the fruit bat? So, you know, we talked about it, whatever. So we started supplementing with larkeet food, which is like a powder, and you just kind of dip the head of the rat into it, and, you know, I guess you have to watch, though, with, you know, over-supplementation. But I haven't had any issues, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think theoretically that's an issue, and I've always kind of wondered with the red patch, you know, super pig stuff that I'm using. But, you know, I just do the same thing. I dust the ass end of the rodent, and, you know, only because honestly, that super pig has some cayenne pepper and stuff, and if they get a real mouthful of it, some of them, especially if they're not used to it, they'll refuse it just because it's kind of a strange thing. And I suppose doing that sort of stuff is what makes me like snakes that are really willing to eat because, you know, they'll just go for it, whatever.
Right.
Bringing it back home, you know, for just a half second to the ball python thing is like, man, I would be so bummed out with ball pythons, especially if I only had one snake, because it's like, dude, I love stuff that likes to eat. It's not that I want to feed them all the time. I don't. You know, I'm with Zach. I'm with you on that. With the both of you on that. But, like, dude, if I offer it, I want it to eat. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I like going 60 for 60. That makes me happy.
Yeah, me too. That's the best feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yep, for sure. You know, so.
One of the things, just on a side note, since we're talking about feeding and stuff, one of the things that I noticed, and I don't know if you've ever seen this, Zach, but for some reason with my IJs, if they refuse, right, if you go back in and offer it to them a second time, the second time
they take it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Have you had that?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I get that all the time. Or, yeah, they'll drop it, and then, you know, I'll come back and try it again, and they'll take it. Or they won't take it that night, and then in the morning when it's stinky because it's been sitting in an 80-degree room all night, is that little stench going on? Oh, they go crazy for it.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of crazy.
I also think that it's probably because I do thaw out in water, and so naturally a rodent that's been thawed out, you know, not in water, is going to smell probably a lot more pungent than something that's been soaking in water for an hour. You know what I mean? So,
right. So
I know that I'm probably washing away a lot of that rodent scent. Not only that, I do soak all my rodents in the same tub. So rats, African sulfurs, and mice all go in the same tub. So I'm pretty sure all those scents are all mixing in. So I do notice that if I do have one that's a little more finicky, I'll try it that night. I may try it a second time. If it's not taking it, I'll usually leave it in the cage. And in the morning, try it again, and 9 times out of 10, they take it.
Right.
Once it's been sitting in its mouse juices, you know what I mean? It's been kind of like marinating there for a little bit. That's when they take it, no problem. It's not a blue tongue will eat it, so, I mean, nothing goes to waste around here, but even so, I hate when they refuse. I can't stand it. And I have that one IJ, oh my goodness. She it's weird. She will only eat hopper-sized mouse.
Huh.
You put a regular-sized mouse there, she won't touch it.
Really?
You want to talk about finicky, man. I mean, I'm talking like, and it's like, if you present it to her and you wiggle it around, she'll get scared and then she's not going to eat it. You have to literally just place it in her cage, close the tub, walk away, come back in the morning, and it's usually gone. If it's bigger than a hopper, she's not touching it. Crazy. I don't know what to do with this one. I'm going to get my ropes with this one. And it's funny, you produced her. Well, then.
You let go of that one, huh?
Oh, man.
Interesting.
Here's that.
No, I mean,
this one. Yeah. All right.
Was that number six?
Yeah, man.
Number six, yeah.
No, number three is like, you know, triple the size of all the other ones and eats rats. You know, she's perfectly cool. But number six, oh, my Lord, man. It's a constant battle. But she's so drop-dead gorgeous that, you know, we'll see. I'm not holding my breath, but, you know, she's a cool snake. She's, I don't know, maybe one day it'll click in. I don't know. Maybe if she gets a certain size, maybe she'll start, you know, seeing other things as prey. I don't know, but it's really strange. It's really just
maybe lay some eggs or whatever. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
I have what's that?
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I do have a little F2 Arubiac. It's probably a male from, like, late 2012. And that dude he's a pain in the butt, too. Like, you have to present it super slowly and then basically just hold it still, maybe give a little pullback. And I'm doing, like, fresh-killed, like, crawler or hopper mice. And this is kind of an old kingsnake trick, right? Express a little bit of the brain through the nose. And that works for a while, you know. Kind of once and it's got to be really hot, so I'm holding it to the light bulb, you know, to get it super hot, expressing some of that brain, and then he'll get going on it. But, you know, lately he had stopped doing that, and I said to Jason Stevens, hey, give me one of those chicks. I tell you what, man, I put a little of that chick down, so I did that in the same process, express some of that brain, and put the chick down in the brain, like just stuck it on, you know, through there. Man, he hit that thing hard.
Yeah, they do love that chick down, man.
Yeah.
Actually, it's funny you say that. I had so my jungle clutch of 2013, right? I had one holdout, and I'm kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm an idealist, but I believe that, like, I don't, like, the assist feeding, I don't want to, I'm not down, I don't know. For some reason, I think that a bad feeder is going, like, if a bad feeder survives, it's going to produce more bad feeders. So to me, I try to hold out as long as possible until they finally click with it. And, you know, this jungle carpet, okay, what we're looking at, it just took its first meal. Okay, it was born in last June. Took its first meal a month ago.
Wow.
I know how that goes. I mean, heck, I think we were talking about those rhinos, those little rhino rat snakes that, I don't know. I just kind of waited 8 months to start feeding.
Yep. Yeah. I mean,
it's like, oh, well, they're just sitting here. And I mean, those, that part of it, right, is that those snakes are incredibly able to, you know, their metabolism is very slow. So it's just like, well, you look the same as you did 8 months ago when you hatched. So maybe we'll give you a shot. But I hear that.
Yeah, it was crazy because, I mean, the thing hatched out at 33 grams. I mean, so you talk about a big baby carpet. You know, I mean, it ain't thick. Right? So, I mean, the whole clutch was 30 to 33 grams. It was like a monster clutch. But, you know, it just wouldn't eat. And, I mean, it looked like it was on death's door. And I was like, all right, I got to do something here. I was like, I can't watch this thing die. And so, you know, I got a chick from Eric. Put a little chick down on the hopper. Oh, he wanted it so bad. But at the point, he was just too weak because he just hadn't eaten, and he was very weak. And so I had to lob off the head of the hopper in order for him to swallow it because he couldn't handle the whole thing.
Right.
And 3 days later, he ate an unscented hopper, no problem. He just needed that little kickstart, which made me feel real guilty. Because maybe I should have done this maybe 8 months ago. But no, he's rocking it now, and he looks like he's going to be fine. He's going through shed now, so. But yeah, so I don't know, but that's learning.
That's cool. That's great.
I wanted to see. You know, people say, "Oh, they will starve themselves to death." I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, come on, this food, they're going to eat it, you know? I was like, maybe that's just people say that because they're being impatient. So I wanted to see, I'm like, will this thing not eat? If I offer this thing, how long will this thing go? And that thing was hell-bent on dying, for sure. It's amazing.
it's a real thing, for sure.
Oh, yeah, and I tried one of my skinks last year, one of my tree skinks, had stillborn birth. So she had a couple stillborns, and so I froze them. It wasn't, you know, I kept them. And I'm like, wow, perfect, you know, baby carpet food. Come from the same area, you know what I mean? This is what they eat in the wild, the little
right.
lizards and little skinks. I was like, oh, perfect. I didn't want nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. I was like, Jesus Christ. I can't get it right. Put the chick down? Oh, forget it. I was like, that's the key. That's the key right there. That chick down is gold.
Yeah. That's worked for me numerous times. It actually worked for me with the Halmahera female that I have. Couldn't get her to eat worth nothing. You know, and I think it has to do with, again, I go back to they get stressed easily. They're a shyer species. At least that's been my experience with with the whole three that I have. But, you know, she, you know, I put her in quarantine. I didn't try to feed her that whole time. Then when I pulled her out, tried to feed her. She didn't want no parts of it. She didn't want no parts of a rat, no parts at all. So I talked to Owen, and he said, you should try chicks. So sure enough, I got a chick, and whew, that was like instant. Boom. She took it right away. Like, oh, well, there we go, you know. But real quick, just to go back for a second, I got a message in from Brian Fisher, and he was the guy that put that thread over there about diets and supplements over on the MVF. And he had a couple of thoughts, and one, to Zach's point on quantifying it, does he supplement his lizard food, meaning you, Zach, do you supplement your lizard food, and how is that quantified? Lizard guys recommend it without thinking twice. What makes snakes different?
What makes snakes different is if you don't supplement your lizard's food, it'll die. And very quickly. I mean, you're not talking, it'll have issues right away. And so what my point with that is, we've been keeping snakes for how long? And clearly most of us do not supplement, and clearly they're surviving. Lots of them are living their decent lives and living to decent ages. And so, you know, he's totally right that lizard keepers have to supplement. We have to. And it's something that every lizard keeper has to be on point with, or they will see issues very, very quickly. And so, I mean, I don't know. You know, the going thing is that we feed snakes whole food prey items, and so you're having, you know, you're feeding something that's already nutritionally complete in theory, and so that's why they're getting all the nutrients they need from said animal. When we're feeding roaches and yada, 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 we're feeding something that is not nutritionally complete. So we have to supplement that in order to make up for that. So that's the going theory. Could we be feeding nutritionally deficient rodents to our snakes? Oh, without doubt, I'm sure we probably are. Have we seen significant nutritional issues? No, we haven't. You can quantify it in a certain way. I mean, I could take my animal to my vet, and she could do a blood sample, and she could break down the whole thing for me and tell me what this animal's deficient in, what it isn't. I mean, she can do that without a problem. It's going to cost me $400, but she can do it.
Right.
And again, that's one of those things, you know. But it's tough. It's very tough. I know, you know, you have people like Quipashi, you know, he does studies, some really amazing studies with the lizards. But you're also talking about an animal that has a much quicker, lifespan. I mean, you can have multiple generations.
Maturity span on those is much, the generational.
Yeah, so you can, so you can see the progress, or you can see the problems very quickly. A snake is so evolved to be such a surviving creature that, I mean, they could live nutritionally deficient and, you know, not have a problem. Some of these lizards, I mean, you don't have enough beta carotene, these things are going to drop dead very quickly. So, you know, it's different. It's hard for us as a keeper of snakes to try to quantify it in any significant way without doing the blood work, without doing major scientific studies. And I think that's why a lot of us aren't trying it or feel like it's not necessary. That's probably what it is. And it's probably because we're probably lazy. That's why you keep snakes, right?
Yeah.
There's more than a kernel of truth to that. Okay.
Yeah.
That's why we all don't keep monitor lizards. You know what I mean? Like, it's probably because we're a little lazy in that respect.
Yeah. Good point, Zach.
I don't know. Just kind of bringing the realist here. I don't know. That's my whole thing. I mean, we're a little lazy about stuff like that. Snake eyes, you know.
Yeah, I think I kind of understand what Brian's trying to say, but maybe I can't relate to it because I'm not really a lizard keeper. But you know, and that was kind of the point that I was trying to say earlier, is that I don't know whether you need it or not, but you know, would it hurt if you do it? And I guess you'd have to be there. And that's kind of what you're saying, Zach, is how would you be able to see if it's even worth doing? Like, do you bring any positive results to the table for your effort? You know, or
right.
is it just a waste of time and money?
Yeah, that's, I mean, you know, everybody's like, oh, put UV and all that. And, you know, I hear you. It's nice. But, like, you know, I would have to feel like there was a reason to do so. And,
I don't
know,
though. Evan's brittles coming off that UV are pretty darn pretty.
Yeah.
Am I right or what?
Yeah. I mean,
It just doesn't make sense. You know, I keep going back to this. You know, a lot of times it seems like to me that it's just the simplest thing, and it's standing right in front of you, and we overlook it and try to make it more complicated than it is, you know. And it just seems to me that, like, an animal that uses the sun doesn't benefit in some ways from it. Not just heating, you know, raising its core temperature. But, you know, even us, you know, we process vitamin D the same way, right?
Yep.
I mean, don't we need the sun to process vitamin D?
Yeah.
Yep.
You
know, why would a snake be different?
Well, I think.
Well, do we really want to get to
bread.
This, Eric? I don't know, ectothermic animal, endothermic animal, one's nocturnal, one's diurnal. I mean,
you know what I'm
one's
saying.
An animal.
I get what you're saying. But if it works that way for a lizard, right? That's
right.
A reptile, right? It's a
okay.
reptile. So what? It's a snake and a human are different. And they use the sun in different ways, but a lizard and a human use it the same way? That doesn't make sense to me. Because that's what we're taught, you know?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, I get you. I think it makes sense. And it's just one of those things where, dude, honestly, I think we've become spoiled because most snake species are sitting on two, they're tough as nails, right?
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's the point Zach made, is that do they need it? For the vast, vast, vast majority, and I can't even think of an exception, you know, offhand, they don't.
Right.
But would it make a difference? That, I don't think, is nearly as clear. You know what I mean?
Right, right. And I 100% agree with that. I do.
And I mean, honestly, I was toss this out to you, Eric and Zach, as something to discuss. I was... You know, I don't know if it had just been the nature of the exposures previously or kind of bias based on what people had said or whatever. I was really pleasantly surprised by the interview that Dan Natouche did on GTP Keeper Radio. And I found a lot of what he said really interesting. And one of the things that really struck me was kind of what he talked about where chondros live, how they live in undergrowth and how they live, like, right off the floor, right? And so, I mean, again, it becomes an issue of, well, how much sun do they even get? You know, A, they're nocturnal, and B, are they actually even sitting exposed in the sun or just dappled sun or, you know, what's even going on? And it just, to me, highlighted, man, we think we know what's going on, and we really, the wisest of us realize that we realize at least somewhat the extent of what we don't know. You know what I mean?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I mean,
but,
that's a good point.
Yeah, it's true. But I mean, even like if we can, the UVB thing, we can bring this back to lizards a little bit. It only seems like recently there's been a shift even in the lizard community away from UVB.
Really?
So, yeah. I mean, I've seen it. A lot of people who used to say, oh, you need UVB in order to keep gay geckos. You have to have UVB. That's a necessity. A lot of people don't anymore. They supplement their, you know, their feeders with vitamin D3. So rather than the animal producing it from themselves, they are supplementing their food with vitamin D3. So the UVB becomes obsolete and unnecessary. When I think about UVB, and the reason why I'm not it, I use it sometimes. Sometimes I don't. It depends on the situation of the animal. But why I have problems with it, as a general consensus, is that it's so unlike the natural sunlight. Okay, so we may say all day that UVB is what they need and everything else, but to be honest, it's so minuscule compared to the actual
sun. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's so minuscule. I mean, it's almost nothing in compared to what the sun produces in terms of radiation, that it's almost negligible. So, you know, a common thing people say is an hour of real sunlight equals a week of UVB bulbs. So if you take your lizard and you stick it outside for an hour, it's generating as much D3 in its process, in its body, as if you had it under UVB bulb for a week. I mean, that's how minuscule it is. And so when people say it's that needed and it's that natural and it's that, it blows my mind because it really isn't. It's trying to replicate something that you can't replicate. And so, to me, I feel diet is way more important than UVB in terms of lizards. So, you know, if your diet's not correct, that is going to affect your animal more than whether or not it was exposed to UVB or not.
Right.
You know. So I don't know. It's a very interesting thing to think about, and it's something that debate will happen until, you know, at the end of time. It's one of those, you know, hybrid versus not hybrid debates. You know, it'll never end.
Right.
Oh, forget it. You bring up UVB with some lizard guys, and it'll be, you know, a thread as long as your arm. You know, it gets ridiculous.
Wow.
And I sit on the it's not really necessary end of the spectrum. I know people like Josh, who, you know, sits on the totally opposite end of the spectrum and thinks I'm a nut. So, I mean, you know, both of us have success. So, you know, where does it sit? So, I don't know.
I'm just thinking out loud. What if the whole UV light thing comes down to just having the snakes look nicer? And what I mean by that is I think of, like, jungle carpets, and as they get older, they kind of muddy out. Do you think that, that
yeah, the
having
jungles
that
or the brittles or whatever, you know, any of those things,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's possible that with that light you would be able to extend the life of that, so to speak? Nutritionally, you don't need it. You know, it's not necessary. It does nothing really for the health. You know, I guess, like, when you look at from a human perspective, we're all about the way we look, you know. When you're looking at a snake,
sure.
You don't really, you know what I mean? You don't really care. You do, but you don't. It's not the same type of thing. So, like, is it, would it be possible that, you know, it could aid in that? You know, so if you're going to sell brettles, you're going to have a redder brettle. If you're selling a jungle, you're going to have a more, you know, a yellower jungle, or, you know, a more white aroo or whatever. Just a thought. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I don't know. I think it's at a minimum possible. You know what I mean? And there's some reason, or more likely some multiplicity of reasons, right, that the wild aroo and wild Meroki and wild Biak, you know, look different than their first generation, at least, captive offspring.
I have a theory on that.
Okay.
Well,
I'm all about it. What do you got?
I think this is my theory on it, on the whole white aroos and white Marooks and such like that. I think those are the animals that are phenotypically labeled as such, and so they may have came from clutches of very green animals, and they may have been the standout. And, of course, to us, standouts get bred more, right? So the high white are going to get bred more than the green, just the plain Jane green one. Generally, because you're going to spend more money on the high white one, and generally the person who's going to get that one who's going to spend more money is going to most likely end up breeding it. So I think what we're seeing is that I don't think it's so much that
the locale phenotype looks like that. It's that's what
right. I think that's what we are trained. I think that's what we are trained to believe it looks like. Okay,
right.
So you know we say, oh, that has to be an Aru because look,
that's
it has all that white.
In us.
right. Yeah, exactly. So you know when it produces its first, you know, clutch in captivity, and we have one or two decently white animals coming out of that clutch, and we're like, oh man, see, obviously it doesn't translate into the clutch, and we're like, oh, we'll give up on it or whatever. If you take those whiter animals, right, and you breed that out, and then somehow what we're doing is we're ending up, I think that's what we're seeing, like Ryan Young is seeing this, is that we're ending up concentrating those genes down. And so what we're doing is we're taking a random occurrence in the wild, right, as it's farm bred or whatever,
and line breeding towards it. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's why we're seeing it maybe second generation rather than seeing it that first generation, because there's not line breeding behind those animals that's coming in. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
I think that's, to me, that sounds a lot, like that just makes more sense to me. Because then I think if that was the case, if white was if more sunlight equaled more white animals, wouldn't we see all the localities have a lot of white?
Well, that's the thing, is maybe it varies based on the types. And heck, dude, we, you know, pretty much all agree, right, that Arus and Bihaks are different species. And,
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And
yeah,
so it's
yeah.
like, well, maybe in the one, it may, you know, all that sunlight gives a Bihak, you know, or at least, I think based on what Dan said, right, like the dappled sunlight they're exposed to gives a Bihak that kind of darker look, right? You know, whereas in a Aru, maybe it goes for the flowers and the high white and stuff. And then if you're an ass like me, you have those F2 hybrids that are going around. Although, which is funny, right? I, that whole thing cracks me up because, well, two side points, right? One would be, I don't know why I feel differently about chondros than all other things. Like, you know, I'm very much a purist in regards to the theri and stuff. And I, you know, I would be very much offended if someone bred Rinchofus to maybe Ganyosoma frenata or whatever. You know, that wouldn't be kosher.
That would fly.
Yeah, so I don't know why I feel this way about
we've
even
found,
either locale types
this.
Or...
We found
yeah,
your
you
line,
know?
Rob. The line that Rob won't cross.
Yeah,
we all
have their eye.
You know, yeah, it's variable kingsnakes. Who knew, right? But honestly, I think the short answer to that is that Indonesia is still open and that Mexico has been closed since the early 80s, and I can't get guaranteed pure theri. I need to, you know, from the wild, so I need to, you know, there's a conscious effort, whereas whatever, you know, 1,000 green trees coming from Indonesia every year or whatever the CITES quota is, plus the farm stuff or, you know, the farm stuff quota. I'm not sure what that is. You know, so maybe that's part of it, but I think you know, the other question or the other point, I think, too, is that, and believe me, you know, as we've talked about, I'm all about lineage and stuff, but we recognize, right, that all of the captive bred chondros, or at least most of them with the historic lineage, those are going to be hybrids, too. Because, remember, right. Trooper started with all of the southern stuff, the stuff that only produced yellow babies. But he loved red babies. So he tried to breed in red baby-producing stuff and, like, mix that in. And so anything that's, like, historic lineage is going to be a hybrid for the most part, almost certainly. You know, it'll go back to what the data was on those original animals or whatever, but it's, like, generally speaking, that's almost certainly true. And I think, I think it might have been Bill who said, well, maybe the hybrid issue is why we see, you know, fertility issues in chondros and all that stuff. And I think there's validity to that. I would just point out that it's not just me being an ass with my little F2 or Ruby X from Ryan. It's also anyone who says, oh, here's my, you know, Trooper Wallace blue line animal. Yeah, it's you too, buddy. It's the both of us.
Oh, yeah. But it seems, but to me, it you know, I don't know. I think us carpet guys are pretty freaking anal, apparently, about, you know, the separation of everything. And every, you know, I think the chondro guys, I mean, they, at this point, they really don't care.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there are people who do, right? Like,
I care, but, you know.
You care. Ryan was offended when he saw my little Arubiak Maroki, you know. Like, he was like, oh, that's awesome. Is that an Aru? And it's like, no, Ryan, this is a mongrel. This is an Arubiak Maroki. And he was like, yeah.
You know what? You know what cracks me up about that, though? Here's the thing. Like, and I've said this numerous times, and I think there was a post a couple maybe a week ago on Facebook about somebody saying that all carpets were one species. You know, there was some kind of study done back in, did you see that, Zach? There was a study
I know a lot of people believe that. That's a pretty, I mean, I know Daniel the Douche believes that. I know he outwardly says that all carpets are the same. He doesn't believe in the subspecies delineation or anything.
I kind of lean towards that a little bit, but I know people will think I'm crazy. But, you know, I know they did genetic testing and whatnot, and, you know, it was kind of like what the coastals and the jungles happened. You know, it's like, oh, well, they're pretty much the same snake. There's no difference between them.
But isn't it interesting how that hasn't been translated into the hobby, though?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, like...
Funny, ain't it?
We take this, if it's scientific and, you know, there's a paper done on it, all of a sudden that's the Bible. But then that, you know, taxonomy changes all the time. Look what just happened.
Well, it's only the Bible 15 years on, right? Like all those new geniuses for, I think they got rid of Apodora and they, you know, moved all those crops around and stuff. And it's like, maybe in 15 years we'll think about taking that up as a hobby, but... For now, it's too early, thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks for looking.
No, but you're so right. You're so right. It almost seems like the hobby chooses, once it gets comfortable with something, it doesn't change. It's like why we continue to call chondros chondros. Why we always view scrubs as Moralia. We always will. I don't care what anybody says. You know, in our minds, they will be Moralia. That's just it. That's how it is. So, you know, I think we get stuck... You know, this is how it is. This is how we were taught. And I think, you know, I don't think it's going to change.
I have a theory, though, on why. I think it would be more acceptable, right? I think people would be more willing to accept if an inland and a coastal were the same. But the jungle and the coastal, right? It's a jungle.
No.
And it's like, it's sort of the... You know, jungle carpet python
is so
like
bright,
one of the carpets, and it's like, oh my god, you know? Wait a minute, that's the same thing as my coastal. Oh, there's no way. You know what I mean? It's just impossible.
No.
So it's like, no, I can't believe that. You know.
Speaking of that, dude, how's that albino inland project coming along?
Yeah, right.
The flaming blueberry, dude.
Yeah, right. That's true.
Oh, wow. It's funny. It is funny, though. It's funny, the dynamic. It just cracks me up.
Yeah, and you know, the same guys that won't cross, you know, carpet pythons, then the, you know, they don't believe that green trees are two separate species, possibly three, you know. It's like, oh no, I can't do that. It's just weird how it, you know, how that translates. But me personally, I don't know. There's certain things I won't do, and then there's, you know, like, for instance, a brettle jag, right? Because what do you do with those babies that aren't a jag?
Right.
Like, right. I mean, those screams are pretty crazy, but what do you do with the non-jags? Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't personally have a problem with breeding, per se, and producing something like what Casper did with Scream. Because, let's be honest, if you're going to look in
it's
a cage, that's a freaking awesome-looking thing to look at. So, like, my problem would be, again, we go back to being responsible. Nobody's going to want those offspring that are just, you know, brettles, brettle coastal
really?
Cross.
Brettle hybrids, yeah. I mean,
have you asked Casper about those? Those normals went pretty quick, and they're pretty phenomenal. I mean, they don't look like normal brettles either, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, I guess it depends. I guess, like, those 88% brettle jags, I think, yeah, you may have that problem there where they kind of look like brettles, but they're not. But, you know, some of those mixes, I mean, I don't know. Those are diamond brettles jags. I mean, those are, like, totally, normals do not look like, doesn't look like a diamond, don't look like a coastal, it definitely doesn't look like a brettle. It looks like somewhere in between all three. Pretty amazing. But, yeah, you're right. Like, what do you do with 96% brettles?
I mean, I think maybe some of that, right, we overstate because we're breeders. You know, and accepting the whole chondro thing, like, I'm, you know, purely in the purist camp. And I guess, like, so I see the danger in it, but at the same time I say, so part of me says, I guess, like, looking at my king snakes, like, I have, you know, snakes that have been bred for, like, 6, 7, 8 generations. And, you know, strictly in captivity, and it's kind of a crazy thing. But on the other hand, I look at it and say, well, man, if we're buying our projects from just, like, the random pet store snake, that probably undermines some of our, you know, what we're trying to sell the project as anyway. You know what I mean? So I guess I have conflicted feelings about that.
Right.
You know, in terms, I'm with you, but then I'm also like, well, but who's really buying their project snake? The local pet shop. Could be your first snake, but I know, Eric, you're on record as saying, you know, you love your first carpets, but you're not producing from them.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So maybe, you know, if those animals are hybrids or whatever, like, maybe it's not that big of a deal. You know what I mean? So, I don't know. I'm just conflicted about that.
Yeah, again, I think it comes back to being responsible. You know, like, I would never breed one of those and say it was a jungle, even though the one looks like a jungle. You know, I mean, it could pass as a jungle, but I have no way to know that it is or it isn't. And I could breed it as an undocumented jungle, but why would I go and breed that when I have ones that I'm sure of where it came from? You know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't make sense. So that's just a pet, and that's fine. You know, I have no problem with that. But I think that's, I don't know, you don't have to breed everything. You know,
just because you have it doesn't mean you need to breed it. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. You know, I mean, it's, you know, and I know one of the other topics that we had was multiple males for a project.
Oh yeah, no, this is a good one, and I think I'm very curious what you guys have to say about it, because I think this is where our OCD is overplaying, kind of, you know, snake physiology and reality and hurting our results. I feel like snakes in the wild, and we see this even with, you know, the ball python people who are trying, you know, they'll just run all these males through, and they're seeing these clutches, right, where the female's laying eggs that could only have been produced by, like, a combination of 3 or 4 different males. Like, one male couldn't have even done it, you know what I mean, based on his genetic makeup. And I feel like that's probably how snakes work in the wild. is that they're supposed to be, you know, this female's kind of cruising along, and then you've got all these males vying for her attention. It's not one male gets the job done. It's a combination of males, you know. Go for it. And I think honestly that maybe, you know, the Condro approach, the carpet approach of saying, honestly, it's tough because I couldn't be more of a proponent of lineage and thinking that's not because I think it's necessary, but because I think it's just awesome. You know what I mean? Like, to me, when Buddy says this snake is descended from the first clutch that was produced at Sedgwick County Zoo in 1976, it doesn't change the snake, but it changes my experience of the same snake. You know what I mean? It's just, to me, that feels awesome, right?
Right.
You know what I mean? So I get that, and I get why we want to be able to say it was X times Y, and it's awesome. But I don't feel like, I feel like that's our OCD, not how the snakes are meant to work. And I know with all my rhinos this year, I'm running all my males through all my females. Because last year, for the first time in at least 10 years, I didn't produce any. You know, I didn't get eggs from any of my adult females. And I feel like it was because I said, this male goes with this female, this male goes with this female, this male goes with this female. And for whatever reason, those pairings didn't work, and so I got none. I'd rather be in a spot of saying, well, here's the mom, you know, and I ran these three males through and got some cool babies that I'm feeding and will turn into cool experiences for people, and sitting there going, well, I know who the father wasn't because no babies were produced.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And I know, like, I mean, heck, dude, even, you know, Jason produced a awesome clutch of Arfax, like, what was that, 4 or 5 years? I mean, he's produced many, but the one from 4 or 5 years ago, well, you see with all the Condor guys, I'm pointing him out in a positive way, but a lot of them do it. They say, oh, put in this male that I'd originally planned. Didn't work out, so a month later I put in this male. And then they just kind of run with, like, oh, it was from this one. Jason, to his credit, doesn't do that. And compared it to subsequent clutches with a certain father and whatever. But it's like, well, you're just kind of assuming that it didn't work with that initial, you know what I mean? Like, at some point, this has just become, you know, self-knowledge to self-deception, depending on how you want to feel about it. And it's just kind of like we're selling ourselves a bill of goods as opposed to just saying, as I say, you know, I don't consider myself too clever, but, you know, kind of looking at it last year and saying, well, I would rather have had babies than know who the father wasn't because I didn't produce anything.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's interesting.
Or do you think I'm way off base on that?
Well,
which I think would be hard because, honestly, I can clearly see both sides of the issue.
I don't know. You know, it's as far as carpets go, it seems to me, and I don't know if I do this purposely or not, but when I'm dealing with a quote-unquote pure subspecies, lineage plays more of a factor in it for me than when I'm dealing with my morphs that I'm crossing. You know, I like to know really what it comes down to with that is I just like to know what subspecies is in there. For instance, when I'm breeding it, I want to know if there's IJ blood in there because if I all of a sudden have red babies pop out, you know,
yeah.
I want to know
what
that's...
I don't know if it's just awesome or if it's IJ influence. Yeah, sure.
Right, exactly. So, like, I do have multiple males, but I don't necessarily, in my breedings, I don't necessarily have them go. But I tell you what, though, I have a couple females and a couple males that I can't get to go, and it's because I fall into that rut that probably what you're talking about is that I put this male with this female, and that's it.
And I
get
nothing. With the morph stuff, right, it's easier because you can just say, and I think that's the ball python thing, is they just don't do it with recessive traits, so that it either is the gene it expresses or it's nothing. You know what I mean? And so
that's
where they have it easy. Yeah,
that's kind of why I move towards not working with, if I can at all. Like, if I'm working with a male, originally, like, I would get a something-something het albino. Rather
right.
than now I'm working with just a something-something albino. Because now,
right.
regardless of what I do, it's going to be het albino. It doesn't matter who the dad was. You know, as long as they're both albino, it's not going
right.
to make it.
Then you can say that they're for certain hets, or maybe even you have a situation, right, where you're running an albino and your female's a het, and it's just, and your other male isn't an albino or a het. You just say, if it's normal, you classify it as a normal, even if it maybe it's a het albino. You know, the chances exist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
maybe
I don't
gun,
need...
You just say, no, it's normal. You
yeah,
know?
It's kind of like an added bonus, you know what I mean? Like, I would never,
right.
I don't like the whole idea of possets. I don't know, it just seems like maybe, I don't know why I don't, but I, just the idea of like, oh, well, it's possibly going to be what you wanted, and it's a little bit cheaper, and hopefully, when you raise it up for 3 years, take a shot. You know,
and hopefully I'm not the scam artist who's ripping you off. Hopefully,
so
hopefully.
I would rather be the breeder that said this is a normal something, right? I like
and it
for
turns
example,
out to be het, yeah.
Right,
for
I'll
sure.
take like IJ exantic IJs, right? If I go and I sell IJs and I say, well, that's probably a bad example because there are people that say that they're not pure. Just say it's pure albino Darwins, right? And I have Darwins and these are possets. Well, I'm going to sell them as Darwins. And then if you're lucky enough to get a pair that's hets, then one day you're going to say, oh, shit, look at this. I got albinos, you know, and you're going to be much happier than the other guy.
Well, possets, and they don't
that
prove
door.
Out. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
what about you, Zach? You falling asleep on us over there?
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. I'm just trying to think of, like, how can – I have no experience in that situation. I've never had a male
in the lizard context, right? Like, what if, you know, what if you have a pair that isn't really, it just doesn't seem like that pair works, but maybe it's a lizard that'll accept other males, right? So you have a group context. Are you going to be as happy with those as if you would say, this is definitely the, like Karusha, right? I mean, especially if raised together, you could end up having, you know, sons with mothers or whatever. But you would think maybe it was father with the mother. You know what I'm saying? Like, would you be as
I have that. I mean, I have that problem with my Strilotic colony.
Right.
I have two males, one female. I'm not sure who really, you know, fathered that baby that's running around there now. Well, last year's baby. I don't know who fathered her. My guess it was the more dominant male because I don't think he'd let the other one do it, but I don't really know. I didn't see the copulation. I didn't see it. So I have no idea. I can only guess. But in saying that, you know, now that baby that was produced last year is now next year going to be able to be, you know, reproduced, or she's going to be able to produce her own litter. So, you know, is she going to be bred with her father? Is she going to be bred with the unrelated male? I don't know. You know, so that it is a problem because, you know, for an Australian skink that we don't get any new bloodlines in, I would rather not inbreed if I can afford to. But it's tough. It gets tough in those sorts of situations, especially with colonies. So I understand, like, having that extra male is always a good thing. Knowing exactly who produced that animal is always a good thing. I've even thought about, you know, before my one female of that group, I used to have a 2.2 group. Before one female was injured and I had to get her out and then they didn't accept her back in, before that I was thought about splitting the group. So I had 2.2, split them into two groups of 1.1. So that way I know exactly who was producing each. But it's not that easy when you're thinking of tree skink. They don't.
Right. It's not that easy. And who knows? Maybe you'd have ended up with producing nothing at all from any of them for years on years and years.
Yeah.
You know.
Yep.
And that's where the crux of the dilemma, right, is: would you rather get something from the group with that one female kicked out, or would you rather have gotten nothing from the pairs that you would have definitely known
right.
who the parents
right.
are.
Yep. Because
and
I don't
feel
think...
like the Chondro community at this point is kind of in that latter camp, and that was my approach before, and I just feel like maybe that's our OCD kind of, you know, trying to take over for their physiological reality. You know what I mean?
Yeah, could be. Yeah, definitely could be. I mean, I know for a fact that those I mean, unless the males guarded them in the wild, I really don't see, I know multiple males are going to each female in the wild. Has to be.
Right.
Yeah, but will the female be receptive of the male if she's ovulated and grab it? Or you're just saying that at that point?
Oh, of course not.
Just
but I'm saying,
copulation.
Like, yeah, during the, I mean, what, you're talking about at least a good month of copulations, you know. That male's, I mean, I guess theoretically he could be hovering over that girl and making sure that he's the only one fathering it. But to be honest, in an evolutionary sense, it'd probably be smart for him to go after other girls. Why stick with
yeah.
one?
Right, and the females do the same thing. I mean, heck, dude,
yeah.
I guess what I'm thinking of when I say that is, A, what we're seeing in captivity with the ball pythons, and
uh-huh.
B, like, you see those crazy pictures up in, you know, the Canadian red-sided garter dens and stuff, where there's a single female, adult female, wandering through this pile of, like, 45 or 50 males,
yeah.
all trying to get at it. You know what I mean? Like, that definitely... I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, certainly in areas where the population density is much lower, you're not going to have those kind of crazy numbers. But even then, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, on Aru, what's it like? I don't know.
I highly doubt in the wild that only one male copulates with one female in the wild. That doesn't even seem like a smart evolutionary thing to do. It doesn't make
right.
sense. You know,
right.
it just doesn't. Because... You know, then you're, if it's that simple, like, if it's that, you know, there's not much margin for error there. You know what I'm saying? So
sure.
if you know, that's it. One male, once the male finds that female, they're it, you know? That doesn't make sense. Yeah, that, you know, it, they want to...
And heck, maybe that's why they develop follicles at different rates and stuff. You know, we always talk about, oh, they have some slugs and stuff if we get them too hot, because they were developing
right,
follicles
right.
at different rates. Maybe that's why they do that. So those
right.
ones that are developing in kind of stage two are, you know, ready for a different male.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that. Like, we're thinking that the slugs, you know, are from this, when in reality, maybe you're absolutely right that it's coming from the fact that that's on the tail end of, you know what I mean? When the male you have,
right.
you know, usually if you see copulation and they're locked up and then you're seeing an ovulation, you're pulling the male, you know. I know a lot of people pull the male, and, you know, maybe that's why you're seeing that. And then, huh.
Is if you had a different male that wasn't around for that, he would just go right forward anyway, you know.
Right.
And I mean,
huh.
That's, you know, possible.
That's very interesting.
Sure.
kind of stumped me there. one of the things that Dave wanted me to hit on is just your thoughts, Rob, on he had a good idea about, you know, Halmahera scrub pythons and bioactive substrate.
Right.
One of the things that he was talking about was, you know, the fact that you want them to settle in and you don't want to be messing around with their cage and stressing them out too much. So if you use the bioactive substrate, do you think that that would be beneficial because there would be less interaction with the keeper? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think, well, I guess a couple things. One would be, and I know, Eric, you've seen similar, is that especially like that small one you got from me, if you get them small, you know, and this has been broadcast from Dave and Tracy, et cetera, as being true, and I found it true myself, you know, based on my own experience, the smaller you get them, right, and it just makes sense that they do better, you know, and as you say, I have these three, two of whom were, you know, little teeny babies when I got them, and one of whom was an adult. Like, definitely, you know, now at least... Well, I guess 7 or 8 years into the process for all of them, like, they definitely have settled into a point where they're, I find them to be remarkably docile. You know, they never offer to bite and, you know, do anything troublesome. But at the same time, I definitely get his point, and I think it's largely because they definitely have really good vision and they're smart. And I think the second aspect that appealed to me a lot about that question is that I think those, you know, as much as I personally am a tub guy, I think those tanks are just amazing. Like, I think that enhances the experience so much. It's ridiculous. You know, like,
yeah, yeah.
Animals in that way, like, it's just awesome. You know, and you sit there and you stare at them. You know, and if you can have it in an environment where you can stare at them, but it's not bothering them, not stressing them, I mean, that's just amazing. That's the best of all worlds. I think, personally, in my circumstance, it would be difficult to set up kind of one of those tanks that would meet the needs of a home or any yep. python, really. But I think if you could, that would be, you know, great. I think they are smart snakes. I think they do definitely, I mean, certainly they, even from the tubs, you know, that's my adult female is staring at me right now. You know, she's looking at me saying, hey, dude, you going to toss me a mouse, as opposed to, hey, are you a potential threat? But, you know, if certainly if it was, you know, one that was snagged out of the wild 3 months ago, it'd be reversed. You know, she wouldn't be looking at me as a potential source of food. She'd be saying, are you going to try and snag me out of this, you know, cork bark soup or whatever? I guess, I don't know. I've talked a lot and said a little, I feel like. I feel like they're great tanks. You know, it's a great idea. If you could set it up, I feel like it'd be amazing. But I feel like at the same time, we overthink them. So I don't want to say you need to do them more complicated. I feel like we just need to do them, get them as small as you can, and try and offer as low stress an environment as you can. Like right now, I'm working on a male for Julie that I'm, you know, trying to, well, I mean, he is acclimated. I feed him, you know, or whatever, and he came, I think I got him last summer from Cameron, something like that, at maybe 3 feet. And, you know, he does great. He eats every time. He's dead, just laid outside the hide box and whatever. But at the same time, dude, I think I've only had him out, honestly, probably less than 10 times. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, that's how you should approach that animal. In a year, or nearly a year, you know, I feed him, and then if need be, I, you know, we'll pull fecal material or whatever and, you know, maybe soak the paper a little bit, but, you know, I just leave him alone, and I feel like that's the key. But that being said, I love the question, and I feel like those tanks are awesome, and if you can set it up and do it properly, that's just great. Personally, I think it's much easier to do that with dart frogs and stuff, and I think that's the route I'm going to go, to have stuff that I can just obsess on and stare at.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I just think that's a better fit, but if you can get it done, I mean, hell yeah, dude, more power to you. I'd love to see it, set it up, and take some pictures. You know what I mean? So.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of with you. I really think that especially with that species, tubs make the difference. And actually, if you switch to like the, I know Rob, me and you had talked about, you know, like you kind of steered me in the direction of vision racks and the fact that the tubs, aren't they like on the opaque type of side, like you can't really see through the bottom?
Yeah,
so I think that that would be what would add to the security of the animal. You know, the tubs I don't have don't really work that way. So how I compensate is I keep them high up. So they're not, when I'm in my room, they're not really seeing my hobbit ass walk around. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, and if they choose to see me, they're looking down at me. I don't know if that makes a difference in their mind or whatnot. But it seemed to, especially with the first one that I had, it seemed to mellow him out real quick because when I had him down maybe knee level, you know, and he was in a tank and I just had it kind of set up and, you know, a hot spot because at the time they said you keep him hotter. And if I walked into the room, you would hear thump, 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 you know. And eventually, that's going to hurt the snake. I mean, it's like a constant 20 minutes of thump, 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 thump as it's banging its head against glass. You know, that's not good. So, you know, I changed the way I thought. I just put them up higher, and it seemed to work. So, it's cool.
What about you, Zach?
I've had no experience with that for snakes. But, you know, having said that, I mean, the same applies to, you know, to my skinks. I mean, I keep Key Island skinks, and they're known to be kind of a little more flighty, a little more bitey of the blue tongues, and the same thing applies. I mean, both of mine are wild caught, or they were about, you know, years ago, but still, I mean, the same thing applies, and every time I have an animal in, it's always that acclimation period that I think a lot of people totally miss. Is that acclimation period for about, you know, that the same acclimation period is about your quarantine period. You're talking about a good month, 2 months, maybe even 3 months, depending. And that time, I'm keeping all contact to the bare minimum, absolute bare minimum. I have a tank that I quarantine any skink that comes in. And, you know, it's covered on three sides with paper so they can't see, so they're totally covered on three sides. And the front has four layers of window screen on the front that I kind of, you know, it's like a screen. So it's pretty much I can look in, but they can't really look out. And so that allows me to check on them without ever really disturbing them. And I'm sure the same thing would apply to a scrub and any other high-stressed animal. And so, you know, even, I don't know, it's funny because I get this question a lot. You know, I'll get a new snake in even, and, you know, like, oh, is it feeding for you yet? I'm like, dude, I had it for a month already. I hadn't even thought about feeding it yet, you know? Because that's just kind of like the way I run it. I just, you know, they come in, they just don't, I just leave them the hell alone. I put them in the situation, make sure they're good to go, and I just leave them alone. Give them at least that first month, then offer them a first meal, and then see where that kind of goes, and take it step by step, you know. I want to make sure that they're eating. I want to make sure that they're pooping well. I want to make sure that they're shedding well. And if those three things are happening and everything looks good, then, you know, you can kind of tone back that acclimation period. And you can pull open the tub and stare at them and everything else. But, you know, I think people miss that.
And I mean, a big part of that, right, is just the number of animals you have. Like, I was just, you know, looking at the racks I have, right? And you guys will, A, think this is insane, I'm sure, and then B, say, wow, maybe I need to get some of those. I had gotten a wild female, kind of juvenile to adult rhino rat snake that had been imported from China through Cameron back in 2012. And when I first got it in, kind of contrary to a lot of Asian rat snakes, they do pretty well, or at least they do well or they don't at all. But this one ate a couple times, maybe live, hoppers, something like that, and then it refused for the rest of the season. So maybe it refused three or four times. Then last year, I didn't feed it at all. Literally, you know, I gave it fresh water, but I didn't take it out, and I didn't feed it at all. And it looked exactly the same, didn't lose any condition at all. Went through the year, brumated it, came out, tossed in a hopper last week, and it ate. And now I tossed in a hopper this week, and it ate. And, like, it just needed me to literally leave it alone for a year. Really, considering that was pre-brumation in 2012, it needed me to leave it alone for, like, 16 months. And then it just said, oh, okay, this is cool. Now I'm with you. I'm with your program. This is fine. Admittedly, most pythons, because they have excess heat and aren't living at 60, 65, 68 degrees, couldn't do that. But, like, it's, I think we, you know, I guess my point was that, like, you're sitting there with stuff and you're saying when you have 10 snakes, you definitely wouldn't have the willpower to leave a snake alone for 16 months. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yep.
Like, I mean, I wouldn't. I don't know about you guys. Maybe you would and I wouldn't, but certainly, you know, it's a lot easier with 60 than with 10. Or 2. You know what I mean? And if you had 2 and you tried to approach it that way, it definitely would have died.
Right.
You know?
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah, I know we were talking about that earlier, but I had one of those holdouts as far as feeding, with the one of my 2012s, and that sucker wouldn't eat. That zebra jag just wouldn't eat, you know. And it was like almost 8 months, and then finally it ate. You know, same thing with the Halmahera female. I think that she's bigger, and I think that she got acclimated to Owen's spot. And then when I took her, I think I got to go through that whole process again. And she didn't eat for like a good six months, you know. So finally I got her to where she takes a chick, but I think that she's just starting to settle in and get comfortable. Because I think how Owen was keeping her was different than how I was keeping her. So I actually added a hot spot to her because I'm trying to acclimate her. I think it's important to know what the animal that you're getting is coming from. You know what I mean? So you can kind of like slowly wean it towards your conditions and not just like this drastic switch, you know?
Yep. That's why that's why my new chondro has a heat gradient when my chondros I have in my room don't. He has it because I know where he came from. He did. So I don't want to throw him right into 80 degrees. You know what I mean? And just let him, you know, I'm sure he'd probably do fine. But, you know, my idea is that if I give him that little bit of a choice so that at least he can, you know, slowly get used to it, then it's probably better off. You're better off doing that.
Right.
But that's all resource-based too. You know what I mean?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Not everybody has a quarantine room. Not everybody has 2 quarantine rooms, you know what I mean, or 2 spaces they can stick animals or are allowed to put their snake in their living room if they need to, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, or allowed to be like, hey, babe, these tarantulas are going to live in your walk-in closet this week. You know, like... Not everybody has that opportunity. You know what I mean? I've had that conversation. It's like, hey, I got this new animal in, so I'm treating it. I'm, you know, treating it with some mite spray just in case. So I don't really want the tarantulas around that. So it can't be the tarantulas can't be in the room. So So you know.
Right.
Which was like, what? Like, they'll be fine. Don't worry about it.
Exactly.
They're in there for a good solid, like, 9 months.
Nice.
Yeah. No. Anyway.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly when this is going to cut out. It's 11:53, but I wanted to hit on two more questions real quick, and these are quick ones. But Jason Stevens, Rob, he wrote in a question asking, because you're fluent with other markets and, species of snakes and such, what's your thoughts on the whole Morelia scene?
Right on. Yeah, I mean, honestly, dude, I think you guys have it pretty good. You know, I just tossed out there the advantage to the ball python market coming down was actually, you know, honestly, I think it's liberating because with the price coming down, people can produce what they like. You know what I mean? Like, oh, it turns out a honeybee ball python, right, a ghost spider or, you know, whatever, like, or an ivory. Like, those, if that's your favorite one, now that's like a relatively, you know, reasonable for someone sort of price. And now just make those. You know, it's not about chasing a dollar. It's about saying, okay, well, that's reached $400. and that's just kind of what it will cost to purchase one of those, and now you can work with them, and you can work with genuinely what you like without worrying about, hey, what's the newest, coolest, you know, $10 billion thing that no one actually pays $10 billion for. And I feel like you guys have that pretty well cornered. Like, the price is relatively reasonable for, you know, all the different stuff you have to offer, and people, you know, if you like a certain thing, you can pursue what you like, you know, and I think that's great. And I think even the Condra thing is coming in that direction, you know what I mean? Like, certainly, heck, you know, some of that stuff that Kim, who I think you're going to have on next week, honestly, dude, yep. You know, some of those animals, those Joe Black animals, like, those are awesome. The fact that she produced those, like, patternless black plush super dark red babies and stuff, that's amazing. And I understand why she'll want $4,000 or $5,000 a piece based on their potential. I think that's probably what she paid Greg Maxwell for the founder male. And if you bought those, you would expect similar results. At the same time, that's obviously... that's not feasible for me. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I don't think it's feasible for most people. But that's okay. I understand that. And that's fine. I don't need it. I certainly can understand how it would cheapen it if that was achievable for everybody. But I guess, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, you, Eric Caprice, and all this stuff that's, I mean, heck, dude, if those Poison Ivy... IJ has produced how what I think they will. Man,
right.
I don't think you'd sell them for anything. Like, if they act out what I think they will, you're not going to sell those things for anything. You know,
I don't even care. Rob.
That's great.
Help me out
you
here,
know.
Rob. you told me that he needs to give one to his IJ brethren in his immediate area.
Well, see, maybe he just needs to be—he needs to be buddy and do that, you know, and that's fine. You can just put that pressure on him,
right?
Yeah, but you're not helping me talking about priceless animals and whatnot. You know what I mean? Kill me over here, Rob. Come on, buddy. It's bad enough trying to get a regular IJ out of him. Are you kidding? I'm never going to get one of those damn babies. Good Lord! All right, go ahead. Carry on, Rob.
But at the same time, maybe you have your expense, I don't know, you say those things that have like four or five names, and I'm just like, wow, caramel albino super zebra craziness, and I'm just like, wow, dude, that's a lot of names, and it's like a fucking awesome snake, you know, and I'm sure they are $10 billion or whatever, and that's fun, and dude, if you can get $10 billion, go for it, you know, that's sweet. And I'm, honestly, that's legit. It won't come from me, but maybe there's someone who, it's not a question of the value of the animal. Although I would say, honestly, dude, I would price your Poison Ivy IJs at more than whatever those crazy things are. But that's just me, you know. But I mean, that's at the same time, that's true for anything. Maybe someone else, Zach and I, are into those. Maybe Owen would say, no, your most important clutch is your Cromwell's. Caramel zebras or caramel super zebras or whatever. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's the advantage that you have as the producer of many different things is that what appeals to he and I, you know, to Zach and I isn't what appeals to Owen. And that's, hey, dude, you're in the catbird seat. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
You get to keep the best stuff for yourself and then you got people who are going to pay for your rodents and cages and new acquisitions.
Right.
And I think that's awesome. That's awesome. You know, once you get to the point where you're producing stuff that's helping you pay rather than just paying in from, you know, going to work, that's you're winning, dude. You're winning.
I can't wait for that day. I can't wait. You know. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't know. With Poison Ivy, Those actually are the one that I'm most excited about, you know. It's like albino zebra jags, yeah, that'll be cool, and I'm sure I love them. And, you know, and that's the other cool thing. You know, I produce for myself first.
Yeah, for sure.
You know,
and, I mean,
you know what I mean?
That's awesome. Yeah.
You know, rather than
even if you already have a couple of them, you'll still, dude, I guarantee you'll produce something where you say, I got to keep that one. I'm not going to keep any. No, you'll keep a couple. Don't worry.
which again, you know, at the whole, we started this whole conversation with me talking about, you know, thinning out certain projects and stuff. And, you know, that's a realization that I've come